And we are live. This is Dark Journalists. It's great to be here with everybody. It's an amazing crowd already, and I can see there's so many interesting comments there. You could just get lost in that instead of actually doing the show. But we're here to do the X Series Part 22, and this is really going to be a pivotal episode because it focuses heavily on where the UFO file went when it left the Rad Lab, which is a crucial factor in determining the entire X steganography that led us up to the situation we have today with Trump in the space fence. And we're going to find, very interestingly, that the mystery schools are right in the thick of it. So we're going to do this very interesting thing where we dance between 2018 and 1888, and it's going to be quite an interesting back and forth. As usual, I'm joined by the lovely and often copied but never matched Olivia.
Hi, everybody.
And, you know, we had such a fantastic time putting out the Catherine Austin Fitz episode for subscribers last week. And also, I guess the week before that, it was just the public available episodes. We had the first hour. And those episodes and Catherine Austin Fitz sort of determining what was going on actually with pension funds and the secret space program. That combination of things with the missing money is extraordinary and forms the backdrop of the entire X series. So all those things, all those pieces kind of work together, and it was great to check in with Catherine again. We have a part three coming up on that next week. We were lucky and very fortunate to see Billy Joel last week at Fenway Park, and it was extraordinary, and the show was fantastic, and I want to shout out really to Chuck, who really Chuck B took care of us in all of this, and it's great. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Billy and his band were very gracious, and we had terrific seats. And
was a magical night, I have to say. It was the best thing this summer.
There were all kinds of interesting metaphysical things happening there, but the least of which was not a fantastic show. And so we certainly had a lot of fun. So that formed an excellent backdrop to coming up this week with so much progress around the X series. So what's fascinating to me is that, you know, this is just a thing, but at 70, somebody with so much energy, Billy Joel putting it out. And you really think, you know, it's an interesting thing. When you're younger, you really take it for granted. But to put it out like that when you're 70 is remarkable. And so my hat's off to him. And it sounded great from beginning to end. So
yeah, it's amazing. I mean, this is the first time we ever saw Billy Joel live. And I'm really sorry that we never went before, because he puts on one hell of a show. The energy was incredible. The band was amazing. The vibe was incredible. And everybody knows, like, every lyric of every song and just sings along the entire time. And the vibe of just being in the audience, everybody just enjoying it so much.
It is. Wonderful. It's kind of like was a real kind of communal experience. And, you know, when I was growing up, my brother was a huge fan of Billy Joel. So the songs were all deep there in my subconscious, and then they were coming alive. So we had a great time, and thank you so, so much. Now, I also want to mention that there's been so many things going on, you know, over the course of the past week, that I'd be remiss not to at least address a couple of them right up front. But before I do that, I want to mention that we have tonight the president of the New Energy Movement coming with us. She's going to be coming on in about an hour, and that is Susan Manowich. And she's going to be discussing breakthrough energy of the kind that we've been finding out was kept in the Rad Lab and developed after Tesla's work was pilfered somewhere along the line. So she's going to be going deep into her new research. And she also is part of a couple new books that are coming out, and her work is sensational. And we caught up on that last week, and it is really going to be an eye opener. So the first half, we're going to go deep into the Rad Lab. We're going to go deep into Arthur Compton and his role in the UFO file. The second half, Susan Manowich and your questions. So that's the way we lined up tonight. Does that sound about right, Olivia?
It does. And Susan is absolutely glamorous and beautiful, but she is also brilliant. So let's put aside the fact that she's got gorgeous blonde hair and, you know, she looks like a model, and listen to her incredible wisdom on the subject.
There is, you know, she's really one of these incredible, remarkable people who has been very quietly in the background without a lot of fanfare doing remarkable work all around the globe on in the areas of the UFO file and breakthrough energy. So she is somebody who's really pioneered a number of movements around free energy devices. So you're going to find out a lot tonight on that front. So I'm very excited about tonight. This episode is going to go, it's basically a two-parter with next Friday, because these episodes are going to go hand in glove, and they're both so crucial. And the fact that it's 22, as Olivia can tell you, there's always a weird synchronicity around us in 22 mm-hmm. for some reason. But one of the things I want to start with is we alluded at the end of an episode dealing with the Rad Lab back in June to someone named A.H. Comas, and why A.H. Comas was handed the reins of the UFO file. And this episode, in truth, although YouTube, the title was a little long for it, but the actual episode is Heirs to the UFO File, Supra et Ultra X-Tech and Breakthrough Energy Secrets. The reason that they're heirs to the UFO file is because at a certain point in time, this had to be turned over. And this is the big, this is where everything goes dark when we look at how these programs developed in the 40s to hide the kind of deep research they were doing around the UFO file. So it's quite fascinating to see where it went. And this has always been the kind of mystery, and people have made a lot of guesses, and there's been a lot of leaps, let's say, by UFO researchers around the fact. And it's also been very, they've pivoted with it on the government side. So it's been very hard to track. The X-steganography, which is something that I think gives us a whole new outlook on all of this, really largely a Rosetta Stone for how to see how the government secrecy program works, is something that I tripped into basically when I kept researching programs that were associated with aerospace. And they'd go up to a certain point and suddenly get defunded and fall to the bottom of the list. And then this thing would come back up and be called X this, X-20, X-15. And then I started seeing the X steganography show up whenever we were around deep events, like the JFK assassination, or when we got later, we were looking at things like Star Wars and the SDI program around Reagan, all these X's again, and that got us into looking at it. So I made a basic regular study out of how the X's surface this way, and we found a number of things, which I bring up often in the show. And I always show at least one or two of those to make sure we're grounded in the fact that the X is something that's documented fact now. Now, I'm sure there are many layers to it. And I think even for what we've put out, we estimated about 10 or 15% of the information that we've found around the X so far is out. Now there's an incredible crowdsource campaign of people coming forward with things around the X's. And, you know, it's filling out the picture really well, because that's basically like a worldwide research team. And so we're going into a whole different level with it. One of the fascinating things I want to start off with is, before we get to Compton, before we get to the Rad Lab, is we've been looking at something called the F-35, which was the X-35. So the next generation was the F-35. And something called the hat trick around it. And the hat trick is actually quite fascinating, because we've, in the past couple of episodes, we've looked at this theme of invisibility around the F-35. And this consists of President Trump coming out at these meetings with Lockheed and coming out to the press and saying, we have these invisible planes. And the press pushing back and saying, no, you don't. And Lockheed saying, oh, you know, don't let that information out, and joking about it and making it into a joke. In fact, this has been going on since November. And the thing about Trump is, he is the kind of guy who likes to press his advantage and will mention things in public and not really, you know, and damn the details, he's going to do it. So we have seen a lot of this with Trump lately. In a couple of his recent statements, he's gone back to this theme of invisibility, and there's been this incredible pushback, as I've shown on this program. But the real question is, why is this happening? Well, the invisible tech is the part of the UFO file. It's a part of that X tech that is being brought forward. There's no question about it. It's already here. That's the thing to note. And Trump is actually just heralding its arrival. That's what we have to keep in mind whenever the X program comes up around at the X-35 into the F-35. Now, this is such a deep breach of protocol on Trump's part that there's actually a major international crisis brewing with Turkey, who was not allowed to obtain the invisibility technology. And so Erdogan over there in Turkey, who's a very, very unusual leader because he leans heavily into a kind of fundamentalism that's foreign to Turkey, which has largely almost been run in a secular fashion for many years. But Erdogan is now saying, well, you know, we're not going to do American electronics now. They have a big trade war. What's that all about, really? This is the next level, the next extension of what's going to happen when these things get rolled out. And this is part of why it's a very slow, careful process. But I wanted to point out a couple of kind of key, crucial news reports along this line. Let's first take a look at the hat trick as we've shown it on this program. We're tracking it tight. It is a hat literally with three aces in it, missing the ace of spades. There's no question that there's deep, deep symbology in the hat trick for a lot of reasons. One of the curious things I found about it is that the hat trick is in quotes. Olivia, can you hand me that red pen? Gracias. Gracias, senorita. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is we've been looking at all aspects of how this technology developed, but it comes right out of it. It is the height of the X program. Now, the invisibility aspect that Trump is alluding to is something they've obviously achieved. We've been working with invisibility and the idea of invisibility since the Philadelphia experiment, which is something that Einstein participated in. And there were so many problems with it that that program went deep, deep black. And we heard strange stories about people literally disappearing and reappearing and getting caught in dimensional waves. I mean, it's quite far out. And it is the stuff of science fiction, and yet it's true. So when we're looking at the hat trick, we're looking at that level of technology. And again, there's steganography throughout these programs. The X steganography is the way to read where the programs go. And the X steganography is something that, although we track it heavily in the deep state and in the UFO file and in the government secrecy and how those secret programs move through these different government agencies, but one of the things I found out is the more we tracked it back, we could find it in the 19th century, in the mystery schools, in theosophy. We could find it in Hermeticism. We could find it among the Rosicrucians. Then we found it in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And it was there, again, representing this effect. Now, very often people get stuck in UFO research because they're like, well, if they are here, they, you know, are these beings from Alpha Centauri? And, you know, what's going on with all this? It's a reasonable question, but I think what I've discovered is very different, that the intense secrecy that arises out of something like the UFO file is the same kind of secrecy that the mystery schools kept occult secrets with. And so there was always something they were guarding against, and there's an echo of it in the story of Atlantis by Plato. And that story basically tells of a massive destruction when men acted like gods and basically nearly blew the planet to pieces. But the effect is so world-changing, you know, it's so galaxy-changing that we have this kind of incredible lid on it through the era of the mystery schools. So I go, you know, the premise is that I'm bringing forward is that, yes, as we've seen through the work of people like Edgar Cayce, as we've seen through the mystery schools and people like Rudolf Steiner in Anthroposophy and Annie Besant and Helena Blavatsky, there was an advanced culture back there that had this advanced technology, and that they, you know, the kind of destruction that took place was something which threatened the entire evolution of humanity. So therefore, the mystery schools had to keep it in this incredibly secretive pattern for years and years. By the time we get up to the UFO file, you know, you could look at it simply as guarding another secret. And in a lot of these documents, as I'll show tonight, it looks like they are guarding a secret, like a technology secret, the way you would guard the atomic bomb. In fact, physicist Robert Saarbarker said, no, it's the higher secret. It's higher than the atomic bomb. But I've determined that what they're actually afraid of in all this is not just another country getting their hands on the technology. They're afraid of this effect that takes place when these things happen. And that includes the missing time aspects. It includes the reality distortion field that takes place whenever people encounter these things. You know, power lines get shut down. There's blackouts. Cars won't start. It's an incompletely other reality where the normal laws of physics don't apply. That's something that they're very concerned about, especially if somebody could reproduce it. So I refer to that effect as apotheum because that's something that I've used from looking at that word over time. And it's not a word that I think is very well, it doesn't get a lot of play because it's buried back there. It's basically has a Greek root, but apotheum suits it. For now, that's what we're going to go with. The apotheum effect is like I was just describing when people encounter this kind of, you know, these sightings and all these things happen. So we're not coming in so much on the here's an off-world civilization and they've got all this advanced stuff. And, you know, that's kind of this traditional thinking pattern, I think, that we get into when we're looking at the UFO file. This is very different. This is like there's a secret that is huge from humanity's past. And it goes back to the story of Atlantis. And it goes back to the advanced spiritual technology they had back there. And all these other things are symptoms about it. And they're, when they come in, they're kind of echoes, and it's like an uncomfortable memory. And we kind of find ourselves hitting up against the same thing that the deep state is hitting up against, in a sense. But their reasons for suppressing it are very different for, say, groups like the mystery schools, who try to let the secret out in a way that humanity could absorb it, and in ways that these groups, these kind of corporate raider groups, wouldn't take advantage of it. Now, on this program, I've gone into great detail about how Annie Besant vouchsafed the material that John Keeley had developed dealing with ethereal energy, and this is about 1898, and some of the really incredible things that he had achieved with early flight. And we're going to see that theosophy, which Annie Besant was the head of at the time, has that central role of basically trying to be the guardian of what happens so that, you know, certain occult secrets, certain esoteric truths, certain advanced technologies don't get out and into the wrong hands so that they're kind of moved into the culture in a conscious fashion. So I think that gives us some setup for the whole reason that we're in this X series in the first place, which is the X steganography is the way we can track the way that the secret programs are moved through government agencies. But along with that, I want to say it's not just a program about tracking government programs. The echo of the mystery schools, if you don't have that piece with the X steganography, you miss the whole thing. So the mystery schools side by side with the deep state secrecy, that's the combination. That's what's going to give us the answers. So the hat trick is something that's public now. We can all discuss it because Trump's making it public with the F-35. Now this is an international incident over it. So let's get past just speculation about it. We can actually talk about it because it's an open secret. So what are they hiding? Very interesting. Couple of very interesting things. One, a viewer was kind enough to tip me off to. It's a story that came out in 2016. And I want to show you how this really ties together closely with all the things that we're seeing, even things like To the Stars Academy and this big CIA push to talk about UFOs now. Everyone's trying to get ahead of the spin on this stuff before it gets found out. And they want to be in the central part so they can basically take credit for it. We've shown over and over again where even presidents have kept these X letters. And I call them stealth archives because they're out there. We know about them. But they're not to be open until 2023 in LBJ's case or 2053 in Eisenhower's case. And we got into this with Nixon's time capsule. It's the same thing. What's fascinating about it is there's an entire kind of tradition and system inside the government for this, for when it comes out and who's going to take credit for it. And those systems and those forces inside the government and inside the deep state, there's a big push and pull. So in this article, it comes from The Guardian now. It's military invisibility cloaks could breach Geneva Conventions. That's the article there. This is crucial, but I'll tell you what's fascinating. The article comes out in 2016. Leading military lawyers say refinements of technology already used on stealth bombers could breach international laws. They're getting ready. They're gearing up for when the invisibility comes out. They're going to turn around and say you can't use it, basically. They're trying to create this. Invisibility cloaks and other future advances. This is straight out of the article, which is by Owen Bocott and Alice Ross. Military camouflage techniques could violate Geneva Conventions, a top military lawyer has warned. So Invisibility cloaks. Okay, well, being stealth on a radar is one thing. An invisibility cloak? It's a little bit different. I mean, has anyone been talking about, hey, things are invisible? We have to get a law against that. This is kind of a breakthrough article in this sense. Scientists and military contractors are spending tens of millions of pounds, it's a British magazine after all, researching methods of generating effective invisibility through more sophisticated, are you ready for the term? Quote, metamaterials. What does that sound like? Well, we have these people running around saying, oh, I'm Luis Elizondo, and I'm, you know, basically, I was inside this program, you know, it was called ATIP. And we're going to prove all this stuff with Tom DeLong. We've got metamaterials that are going to do it. And we have this ATOM program and blah, blah, blah. Very interesting. They're using the term metamaterials, which is what this article in March of 2016, over 2 years earlier, is referring to for the invisibility cloak. So that makes you wonder, when is the CIA trying to roll out and then wrap it inside the UFO thing with phony counterintelligence people like Luis Elizondo? Let's think about that. What are they up to? They're always up to something. And I've stated on this program a number of times that you cannot trust the CIA with UFO disclosure at all. And the fact that around that program and the New York Times, Harry Reid version of UFO disclosure, it's quite disturbing because all those people are all CIA people, and that's not a conspiracy claim. They're identified. I mean, Elizondo was the assistant for John Brennan, who had a meltdown this week because Trump took away, what, his security credentials. He can't get security briefings anymore. Well, he's not the CIA director anymore. But is that a shot across the bow from Trump's side against the TTSA Elizondo phony CIA disclosure? You bet it is. As is their push to get him out so they could move in somebody else who's friendly to that program. I mean, this is, you know, there's a lot of other considerations, but that certainly is a crucial one. Now, it's quite interesting. I want to say a couple of things about the article. They go in here, and if you think that I'm making a leap talking about invisibility, listen to how the article reads. The U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, as we know quite well, developing killer robots as we speak, has been one of the major funders of metamaterial science. There's metamaterial again. Triggering excitable comparisons with Harry Potter's fictional invisibility cloak. I mean, that's pretty clear. They're not talking about being invisible on radar. They're talking about having invisibility. Last year, the U.S. Army announced it was planning to test prototype metamaterial uniforms. I can become invisible when I put on the uniform. Now, I've shown where there were car commercials and BMW commercials that were all about invisible cars. And they had achieved this visually by doing this, but it was a very odd campaign that they did. And that was in 2013, actually. Patented adaptive technology. The same background pattern heat signature is projected onto a series of hexagonal pixels mounted on the target that can change temperature very rapidly to match the surroundings. As a result, an object can be made to disappear into the background for an observer using infrared sensor. Okay, so we're getting hints of how the invisibility is going to be rolled out. On infrared, on radar, you disappear. Eventually, it just becomes a visual thing. I can't see it. That's basically invisible. Where is this push coming from, and how does it relate to the X technology? It's the heart of the X technology. It's a piece of what they're rolling out there. Remember, Apotheum, the UFO file, if you really look and study it, there are tons and tons of cases of planes and boats knocking into invisible vehicles. I mean, it happens. And very often, it's a plane crash, because if they hit it and they don't see it, then it's all over. It's a fairly widespread thing in the UFO file. So the invisibility factor is something that those craft have, and it's something now that we're rolling out. Is there a coincidence there? Let's find out. And while I do that, how are we doing over there, Olivia?
We are doing great. Would you like a question?
Sure.
Okay. Well, the first thing I wanted to bring up, JJK says, since the series began, she's seeing X's everywhere. And we hear this a lot, and I know I'm seeing them everywhere too.
Well, you become more aware. And you start to see, that's what steganography really is, because steganography is something that has to be hidden in plain sight. And so when we're working with steganography, we then have the tool that they use to communicate with each other. So then the question becomes, how do you filter out what they're actually communicating with versus what is just there? And the answer is they can use any of them because that's their system. So anytime it's meant to be out there in plain sight, it's not an easy thing to do. But I think you can start to realize that there are patterns with the X that go back so far that it's a deeply rooted system. This isn't something that somebody dreamed up in 1947 as a way to hide the UFO file. It's an established system of how to move something around and keep it hidden. And I found the X steganography goes right to the heart of philosophy, sociology, esoteric science. I mean, it's quite remarkable when you think about it. So we're right on the tip of something dramatic here that relates to the nature of reality in our world. But if we bring it down as we're doing tonight, we can see how it relates just to this program and how they've moved around these advanced programs into different government agencies where certain individuals were entrusted with it. And funny, over and over again, those individuals act in a circle. So it is very much that small group at the top moving this thing around. Secrecy has its place. There's no question about it. But transparency does too. And there's a certain point at which, you know, this is the Catherine Austin Fitz line referring to Winston Churchill in regards to Hitler. They were all like, hey, you know, we shouldn't scare everybody and talk about this because what if it doesn't happen, you know? And Churchill's attitude was, oh, let's tell the people, you know? And I think that's the better attitude now because the transparency breeds a kind of psychosis behind the scenes with these people who don't know how to handle the power and lose all accountability to the public. So we can't have that. Interestingly enough, on this particular invisible plane issue, I want to get to this. This is another Guardian headline, and this is the rift between U.S. and Turkey. It relates directly to the invisibility technology. Erdogan wants the F-35s. The F-35s have invisibility technology. There's no question about it. They come out of the X-35. They're the first rollout. Trump himself has said it. Now, why is this coming to a head now, and why is an ally saying that they're not going to import American products anymore? That's more than just a traditional trade problem. Well, let's look at this. Israel becomes first country to use U.S.-made F-35 stealth fighter in combat before Americans. So Israel is the first country that's deployed the F-35 before we did in a wartime theater. Okay, that's the article there. Now, Air Force Chief of Israel says, we are flying the F-35s all over the Middle East. Okay, well, if you're flying the F-35s all over the Middle East, they'd be getting shot down left and right. So how are you flying them all? Is that just, a matter of speech? Figure of speech. Interesting to me. They probably are flying them all over the place, and they're impossible to spot. Okay. This one, I have to give a shout out to Bangster Slayer, who does fantastic work with her blog. And Bangster Slayer this week noticed, though, when Trump was giving his speeches before these military groups, that this one was very well displayed. And you'll see, again, here are the X's, very well displayed. Now, that is for sure the mountain patch for the Mountain Army Division, 10th Division. But this is, you know, presidents and political figures and standing next to things and the way that things are portrayed, you can really track X steganography through that. No political figure stands up next to anything without knowing what the repercussions are. In this case, it is very interesting. You've got a mighty sort of helicopter back there with the two X's, and you've got Trump laying it out and saying, I'm presenting it. I've got the X. Does he have the X? Well, he's moving on the belief that he has the X. These weird groups in the deep state are trying to throw him out so fast so that this stuff doesn't go public before they get their hands on it. The Trump administration with the Space Force, with the Space Corps, talks more about space than anyone since Ronald Reagan, pretty much. He wants, that's a force out there. That's an economy that's growing. There's space mining to be had. He wants total control of that. And the groups that are setting this up, that have already kind of pilfered NASA and the whole budget's there and are setting up space for privatization and the massive control out there, they already have their plans. And they were even going to have a nice little UFO threat to boot, courtesy of Hillary Clinton. But unfortunately, she didn't get in. Unfortunately for them. So let's take it a little further. This very, very interesting X-35, which became the F-35, we're going to look at the actual plane for a second. And there's just no question that in the tail, you've got the hat trick going on there, and you have the X's above. And this is how it flies. So it's identifying that this is the X-Tech, and it's identifying that it's got the invisibility. It's just something that is known now. It's an open secret. Something that came to me as someone was sending me pictures of the craft in a hangar, and they did an excellent job of spotting different pieces of it. Here, they found something quite remarkable I'm going to present here for the first time. This image. If you can take a quick look at that here. Do you recognize that? How about you, Olivia?
It's a squid.
It is definitely a squid. Now, interestingly enough, a squid has very unusual properties. One of the properties of a squid, as I found out, there's a whole program that's covering them. Let's see if I have it here. Here it is. There's a video out there which is about this research program going on in universities for the government. And it's called Squid-Inspired, quote, Invisibility Stickers Could Help Soldiers. That's the name of the video. Can't really see much there, but I do recommend it. It's only about 5 minutes. Oh, actually, it's 2 minutes. And there's this whole thing, if you read about squid, that they have this ability to camouflage themselves by, in essence, becoming invisible. So now we have something, another thing with the F-35 indicating invisibility is its key thing. And that's a very mild image that they have there. It's not something that is like in the center of the logo or anything. It's literally just kind of scribbled up there. We did find something else, which was not as easy to interpret, on that F-35, which all this hubbub with Turkey is about, and Israel already has it. This is a figure holding a glass of wine, apparently holding a crown, and it's got some kind of foxtail. What would you call that, Olivia? It's a...
Well, it looks like a mic stand or something.
Like it does. It looks like it's sort of swiveling on a mic stand, holding a glass of wine with a crown and a weird, you know...
That is such a weird image.
It has to be, if it's not, it's not quite an alien head, but it certainly is peculiar, let's put it that way. But these are the kinds of things that, when you're looking at that, you know, there's just something unsettling about the whole rollout about the F-35. I think the squid is the most kind of devastating image for that, to give us a real snapshot. And then this thing now, the F-35 has the hat trick, which is very unusual, which is... the magician's hat, and that is very well known for what? It's very well known for this magician trick of making something appear out of nowhere and then become invisible again. And they've been doing that for a long time, and traditional magic is going to come directly into this as we speak. So, but I want to make it clear, the F-35, which is the X-35, same exact program, same exact technology. And that's what they call it. When you read about the X-35, they say this, which was taken from the X-35. So that's not a leap of faith on my part. Let's connect it up with these comments that I've pointed out. Trump's bizarre comments about invisible planes. To the Coast Guard, read them in full. Quote, this is Trump. They say, well, it wins every time because the enemy cannot see it, even if it's right next to them. It can't see it. That's invisible. Trump got tons of pushback on this. When we pointed it out and we compared it to Wonder Woman and her invisible plane, and I showed this last time, but we're going to bring all this around. 5 days later, they came out with this article. It was syndicated through the Huffington Post, and they showed Trump with that weird Wonder Woman invisible plane. And they were like, you know, Trump just doesn't know what he's talking about. He thinks things are invisible. What's wrong with this guy? And seven times Trump bragged about planes that literally didn't exist, right? That's it. So Trump is letting it out that the X-Tech is here, that he has it, and that he has invisibility. And, you know, he did first give it to Israel. They're the first ones who have taken it into their actual program and are using it. Turkey, on the other hand, for some reason, didn't live up to our code of secrecy with it. Now, here's something to consider when looking at Turkey. Turkey is planning a Turkish NASA. They have a Turkish space agency. They want to launch their own satellites. They want a piece of the pie. And something about they may have had to, in order to get the invisible tech, sign on to something that said, hey, you can't launch your stuff without American know-how and American personnel. This could be the heart of that. But you never see us arguing with Turkey. This is very, very unusual. From a political point of view, forget it. Okay, so we have that public battle going on there. 2018, the battle over the F-35, the mention of invisibility. Let's go back. Let's take it back. The UFO file. Well, the UFO file people often associate with 1947 and the high secrecy. It's a good period. It's a heightened period. But it actually starts a lot earlier. It starts, literally it starts a lot earlier. But just in this modern wing, it starts inside the Rad Lab. And the Rad Lab is something I've pointed out here, which people traditionally associate with the Manhattan Project. But that secrecy, that end of the spectrum, was required to study something that is an even bigger secret than the atomic bomb. Physicist Robert Saarbarker is on the record saying, you know, this is not MJ-12, and this is not any of that stuff. He's on the record saying, this was a program of UFO recon, and then we would study the crash retrievals. That was the top physicist in the country with Robert Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer had been scared after the nuclear tests, and he was easy to manipulate because they called him a communist and they did a number of things against him to make him look like a Soviet sympathizer. So it was easy to kind of retire him. He wasn't going to say anything. Saarbarker was a very unusual story. What they decided to do with him, literally, was in the early 80s, something very unusual happened, which I've pointed out, which is that Bill Steinman, who wrote the book UFO Crash at Aztec, did an extraordinary thing, is that he got an interview with Saarbarker in his response to a letter. And Saarbarker confirmed in the letters that the UFO file existed, that we were studying these things, and that Vannevar Bush was in charge of the program. Now, very often you'll hear Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush is really like the go-to man for science for five administrations. Everything from Truman to Eisenhower, JFK, FDR, and Nixon. So quite a wide range there. One of the things I'd like to kind of point out about Bush is Bush, when we look at him, they rolled out this idea of MJ-12. And you can like MJ-12 or think MJ-12 is not real. Kind of doesn't matter. Wilbert Smith in 1950, as a Canadian official, had a conversation with Saarbarker, was declassified in 1968. It's there on the record. And it says, Saarbarker said, actually, I'm going to read a little bit of that. Saarbarker basically pointed out that Smith there, who was an engineer and a high official in the Canadian government. And, they had these conversations back and forth with Canada over high security issues. In this case, they got Saarbarker. And Saarbarker, I think, was somebody who suffered from honesty. And I want to point out a couple of quick things about what Saarbarker said in response to Steinman's letter, basically asking about, you know, where did this UFO thing come from? Were you involved in the program of crash retrievals, et cetera? Saarbarker responds and says, "Dear Mr. Steinman, I'm sorry I've taken so long in answering your letters. I've moved my office," and so on, moving down. "Related to my own experience regarding recovered flying saucers, I had no association with any of the people involved in the recovery and have no knowledge regarding the date of the recoveries." Steinman had sent him a number of different cases. He said, regarding verification that persons you list were involved, I can say this. John von Neumann, who's in the next episode, was definitely involved. Dr. Vannevar Bush was definitely involved, and Robert Oppenheimer also. My association with the Research and Development Board under Dr. Compton, that's the Compton, Arthur Compton, we're going to get into in just a moment here, during the Eisenhower administration was rather limited, although I had been invited to participate in several discussions associated with the reported recoveries. I didn't personally attend the meetings. I'm sure that they would have asked Dr. von Braun, Werner von Braun, launched the space program, and the others that you listed. They were probably asked and would have attended. This is all I know for sure. I did receive official reports when I was in my office at the Pentagon. Moving down, I do not recall receiving photographs such as you request. I have to make the same reply. I recall the interview with Dr. Brenner at the Canadian embassy, which is where Steinman got the idea to talk to this guy in the first place. So what I remember at the time is that certain materials, this materials again, reported to have come from flying saucer crashes were extremely light and very tough. I'm sure our laboratories analyzed them very carefully. There were reports that instruments or people operating those machines were also of very light weight, sufficient to withstand the tremendous deceleration and acceleration associated with their machinery. So the beings that they found operating the stuff are incredibly lightweight. I remember in talking with some of the people at the office, I got the impression these, quote, aliens, okay, that's him putting the term on the record, were constructed like certain insects we've observed on Earth, wherein because of low mass, the inertial forces involved in the operation of these instruments would be quite low. I still don't know why the high order of classification has been given and why the denial of the existence of these devices. Sorry, it's taken me so long to reply. And at the bottom, he says, it occurs to me Bush's name is incorrect as you have it. Please check the spelling. And it's fascinating because there's his old boss and he recognizes. He's like, hey, you've left an N out there. They have conversations and the conversations run deeper. And we get more information further on from Sarbarker, which basically give us the whole layout of who took over the UFO file. The person that he lists taking over the UFO file is Arthur Compton. Arthur Compton and his brother are both, Carl Compton, they're both top physicists. In fact, Arthur Compton has won a Nobel Peace Prize in physics. He's won a Nobel Prize for physics, not a Peace Prize, excuse me. So let's get a little bit into Compton so we understand where all this stuff comes from. While I'm doing that, I will ask Olivia to give us a heads up on what's happening. Well,
I wanted to throw out a couple things that people mentioned. Preston QB says Fox is in numerology is 666.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll tell you, Preston, you're very prescient because we have a 666 coming your way.
We do. And Charlotte Powell says there's a legend about an immense squid beneath the Arctic.
Whoa, yeah, that's a Native American legend? That. Fascinating. Well, listen, they use a lot of symbology in those legends, let's face it. Who was it who mentioned the 666?
Preston Kibbe.
Preston Kibbe. Okay, mm-hmm. Preston. The program that was started, which Sarbarker mentioned, actually Sarbarker's son came forward, and I'm going to read that in full in a moment here, but Sarbarker's son said that he had these discussions with his dad, and that he said, well, what happened with the UFO part? And he said, well, we would send missiles up after them. This is Sarbarker talking to his son after he's retired now. And the son says, well, I don't understand, Dad. What, you fire missiles at UFOs? It seems like dangerous business. Why would you do that? And Sarbarker says, well, actually, don't get the wrong idea. You know, the front of those things, there were no weapons on them. We put cameras on those things. We wanted to see them, but they were going so fast, there was no way to catch them. The only thing we could do is use a missile. As time went on, of course, you can't be shooting missiles every time a UFO goes by. So a UFO recon program was described by Philip Corso in his groundbreaking book, The Day After Roswell. Corso was the head of the Foreign Technology Office, worked for five administrations. He was the man deep inside. The program that he pointed to was the X-15, which was Walter Dornberger's program. Walter Dornberger, as we've described many times in this program, is a paperclip Nazi. Comes over and creates the X series for us. Those are the space planes which still hold the records for speed, even though they were made 50 years ago. This is one of them. And since Preston Kibbe brought up the 666, why don't we just take a little look at the tail number here. That is 666. Now, it's quite remarkable. I know there's a 7 after it. It's amazing. You know, in America specifically, there are hotels and things that avoided having a 13th floor because of superstitions and, you know, religious concerns and all the rest of it. You do not put 666 in a program. It doesn't happen. And the idea that they would do it on a major program of a space plane called, you know, the X-15-666 in there, it just doesn't happen. It's quite unusual. And when I think about the X steganography around this, if they had a program that was 66671 and they had some classification for it, they would have instantly changed it. They would have done something so that it wouldn't have the 666 connotation. It's very, very unusual that they used it. This is the X-15. This is the heart of the X program. Now they're identifying it with these very occult numbers. It's quite unusual. Even I, who's pretty much, you know, used to seeing these things pop up around the X-Tech, this thing is off the charts. Okay, go for it.
I just want to say, George Ivankovich says, the original Apple computer sold for 666.66.
That's true. I think that was more like a Steve Jobs joke kind of a thing. But yeah, it is quite interesting when you put it together. How odd. See, but the thing is, it's one thing if you can do that, you know, on the technology side. When you are part of the government, to associate a major program that's being funded out of the American taxpayer, you don't put 666 up there in a largely Christian nation. It's a very unusual thing to do.
Although he was very punk rock by nature.
Well, Steve Jobs was, but yeah. I'm talking about Dornberger.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You got to keep up with me a little
bit. Sorry.
You're already 2 questions behind. No, that's me. That's 2 questions behind. Olivia tends to be ahead of all of us by a day or two. And one of the things is, I want you to know that whenever I'm putting a show together and I have all this material ready and I say, oh, I'm going to leave that out. And she goes, you're going to leave out the most important part about where he left his diary? You can't do that, you know. So sometimes you have Olivia to thank for the things that I'll tend to include and not give the axe to. That's the kind of really edgy thing that you get from Olivia. Are you all done? Are you all done?
Yeah, that's it for now.
Okay, fantastic. I'm going to move along then, if it's okay with you. By the way, I want to remind everyone that you've seen the enormous censorship that the alternative media has been going through, and it's working its way around. We saw it with InfoWars. We saw it with tons of libertarian voices, the Ron Paul Institute, and a series of others. And it's just absurd, and it's an attempt to control speech. It's very simple. And, you know, there's this kind of push of collusion going on among these companies all at once to do things like that. Whenever you see that kind of thing happen, there always has to be the pushback and the pendulum swing back. And so we will see that. But in the meantime, you have to really, if you want to stay in touch with us and what we're doing, go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for the free newsletter. That'll keep us in touch. That at least gets us away from the social media networks. I love using the social media networks, but we can see they can shut the lights off like that. And then there's no really place for a public hearing. But if we have that connection ourselves, if we're doing it, then we're all set. That's the way I look at it. So just sign up for the newsletter. What will happen is you'll get a newsletter about once a week telling you what shows are coming up, what incredible guests we're going to have. And while you're there, subscribe. You know, get behind this program. We've made it affordable. We've made it accessible. You're going to want to be a subscriber. And now's the perfect time to do that, especially with the episodes that we have coming up. And, you know, I would really say that it's the kind of thing where procrastination just isn't cutting it. So I would say if people have been on the fence or whatever, just break through the procrastination. Procrastination, while the big companies like the social media engineers are clamping down and really, you know, throwing lawsuits at people and throwing them off social networks, you know, the time to come off the fence has come. You know, get behind the things that are giving you the good information. Support the alternative media. Give them a voice. to fight back and push back with the truth. That's what we need, and we need it on this program too. So we appreciate it for sure. All right, the Rad Lab, their own description, okay, of what after the fact, looking back on the Rad Lab. One of the things that they had to keep deep in the secrecy file was this X-band technology that was developed by the Varian brothers. I bring up the Varian brothers over and over again on this program because they came out of the Halcyon Temple, which is a theosophical intentional society in California. And the Varians are very closely associated. They were like a branch of this Master Hilarion group. And Master Hilarion in theosophy is directly associated with science. And this kind of purple ray that they have for it in his more symbolic pose. But the fact that these two scientists, the Varian brothers, whose dad was the top theosophist in Ireland, who came to America and founded this Halcyon Intentional Society, really gives us an idea of how deep the mystery schools are involved with the secrecy around the advanced technology, if we didn't already have it. Now, the Rad Lab, many of the machines built by the MIT Rad Lab closely resemble, quote, prototypes originally designed by the Serbian immigrant Nikola Tesla. Following his departure from Westinghouse after proving the superiority of AC current over the dogmatic Thomas Edison's DC electricity system, the Van de Graaff high voltage generators, large metal spheres on which lightning danced, were strikingly similar to the earlier Tesla coils that collected high voltage electricity and released X-rays. Let's take a quick look at these things. If we're going to understand what's in the UFO file, we have to see what the Rad Lab was working with, because the Rad Lab got charged in the UFO file. These were the towers. That's a shot from 1942. And these are Van de Graaff towers. Van de Graaff is a very interesting credit to his name. His patent is corresponded with John Trump and Vannevar Bush. You can see that there. Oh, yes. So patent, he has two with John Trump and Robert Van de Graaff. John Trump was called in to do what? John Trump was called in to inspect Nikola Tesla's papers by the FBI. And the his conclusions were very unusual, as were the questions that the agents asked him. That's John Trump there. And he shows up very prominently in this story, and not just for his relation to Trump, but obviously that is the crux of what the X battle is at now, which is that Trump is somebody who got in there and understands the X technology, because John Trump was somebody who used it. You know, these pieces fit together easier when they're brought together in the proper light. The X steganography helps us do that in a way that, like, for example, people going after, you know, I was reading a book by Kevin Randall on the Roswell case, and, you know, it was a great book. But without the X steganography, you won't understand the layers that are going on there and why people act the way that they're acting. It's like a missing piece. It really is a missing puzzle piece. This is more of the Van de Graaff generators. Vannevar Bush set up the fact that John Trump would go off with Van de Graaff and create deep space tracking radar based on these X-rays patterns. But these are basically Tesla-style generators. Now, that technology was available through John Keeley in the late 19th century using the same type of thing. He and Tesla had tripped into this quite unusual energy coils that were basically going to completely throw the entire oil paradigm out. Back then, there'd be no profits to be had. They'd have to use this stuff. Okay, so we're looking at Van de Graaff, Bush, but it all leads back to who? The Comptons. Like, let's finally get to the Comptons, shall we? Arthur Compton, he's a fascinating figure for a few reasons. This is Compton after he won the Nobel Prize for the Compton effect, which is all about light, X-ray, and electromagnetics. He was a total innovator. According to Sarbacher, the UFO file is handed off to him after Bush goes off to run the Carnegie Institute. This is him on the cover of Time. And what they're doing there is they're touting his various achievements, but he will come back and create something called the X-10 graphite reactor, which is one of the earliest uranium processing plants to make an atomic bomb. It's pretty straight up. His brother is Carl, who's also a physicist. He becomes the president of MIT, which is where they run the Rad Lab. Now, there's a whole section of the Rad Lab that is related to the work around Tuxedo Park. And that is a whole chapter that we're going to get into at some point. And it is quite fascinating. But for what we're looking for, actually, on the X side, these are the figures that we want to be dealing with. Compton, Bush, Trump, and the Varian brothers. That's the piece that we need. The other piece, the Tuxedo Park piece, which is fascinating, relates more directly to the Manhattan Project. And, of course, Vannevar Bush was in charge of both. Okay, we're moving now. So let's get a little bit. This is Compton here with Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush is his mentor, as he's mentor to John Trump. And what he's learning here, that is our friend Arthur Compton, who is the Nobel Prize winning physicist, is his new duties after helping to develop the atomic bombs to take over the UFO file and manage that entire process. As Sar Barker said, the study of the beings, the study of the craft. Why is it the craft? They can't break any of the properties of the things that they found. Why do they have this weird stretch metal? Why are the beings inside like insects? You know, all these things. This is their entire redevelopment program. And it takes a while. This is Vannevar Bush. And he is helping get Compton's brother ready. This is Carl Compton. Get him ready to take over as president of MIT. So what we have with Compton is he's basically Arthur Compton is the protege of Vannevar Bush, who's in charge of the UFO file and the Manhattan Project for FDR and Truman. And now he's sponsoring the brother to become the president of MIT, which he was for many years. So incredible movers and shakers right at the very top circles of power. There's no way to get around it. These were the smart guys to trust with the UFO file. In fact, it was a good plan back then, initially. But the secrecy kept on and on and on. Just a quick couple of notes on Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush, the central figure carrying forward the science department, president of the Carnegie Foundation, Master Mason. This is somebody who created, redeveloped the Mason Lodge at MIT so that it would become the Tech Lodge and the MIT Mason Lodge, and they incorporated some of the strictest security, which he would then bring into what? The Rad Lab. The Wall Street Journal called it some of the most amazing security that had ever been taken place at that point. One of the kind of rubs in all this, a fly in the ointment, was the first Secretary of Defense, Forrestal, who we've touched on from time to time in this program. And Forrestal is there with Vannevar Bush, and he's part of the team. But Forrestal doesn't like the idea of the secrecy because what he sees is basically a large-scale need for people to know about these things. They get to an interesting tussle where Truman is pretty much, he's targeted out Jefferson and Forrestal, and he's sort of looked at him and said, you know, James Forrestal, and said, this guy is my main guy. You know, I've put him in charge of Secretary of Defense. It's only like, he's only been in the position for like a year. And now, because of his position, wanting more openness around the UFO file, they have to get rid of him, and that's what they do. So first they try to destroy his reputation, and finally, you know, he has a breakdown just a little over a year after being Secretary of Defense, and finally jumps or is helped jumping in that endeavor out of a window at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Now, the trick, part of the basis that we're seeing, the foundation that we're being that is being laid here that we're seeing is, and that is Truman with Secretary Forrestal. Secretary Forrestal, as a Catholic and for years in government, is very close to John F. Kennedy, who will become president. And he understands now, going in, information about the UFO file. And he also understands that they're willing to kill to cover it up. So that's a kind of a crucial thing when you get to the Kennedy presidency. You know, a lot of people, when they're doing these historical analysis on Kennedy, they're like, you know, oh, you know, his incredible love life. So, I mean, this is probably a little more important, you think, that his close relationship with Secretary Forrestal, knew about the UFO file and got thrown out the window. It's an important piece not to leave out there. So much for PBS, I guess. So what we need to kind of keep in mind is Vannevar Bush has now set up this perfect scenario. He's got the Compton brothers, who are top physicists. He's got John Trump, who is very works very well with the Tesla technology. Tesla is another wild card who they can't quite keep a handle on. So it becomes problematic. And in looking at the technology that gets brought forward, he's somebody who wants to build, you know, the Wardenclyffe Tower to have streaming free energy the way we have streaming free phones now. He's a real open energy, breakthrough free energy guy. And they're looking at him like, you know, if anything, we have to kind of keep surveillance on him. And in fact, we found out there's 24/7 surveillance on him by the FBI at the time. So we're starting to get a picture now. Now a picture's starting to come clear. A couple of things about the influences on Compton, who will take the UFO file in the 50s from Vannevar Bush. We have to understand the Comptons, both brothers. We have to understand Arthur Compton. We have to understand Carl Compton if you're going to get any handle on the UFO file. There's no question about it. So let's look at one of the influences on Arthur Compton. This is a very important Nobel Prize winner named Dr. Roche from the Paris School of Medicine. And this guy is quite important. He's the person who went deep, not only into physics, but also into metaphysics. In fact, he coined the term. Let's look at a couple of other things that Dr. Roche did. And this is quite remarkable. Dr. Roche coined the term ectoplasm after witnessing the strange effects of mediums going into trance and having this unusual matter come forward from them. And the matter seemed to be forming into a figure very often. Sometimes that would happen, and sometimes it would just be kind of an overflow. So he called that matter that came, that metamaterial that came forward from these medium sessions, ectoplasm. He coined the term metaphysics to try to give it some legitimacy so that when they were going into and observing these things like levitation and mediumship and the different things that he was observing, then he had a handle, you know, people could say scientifically, they could be conversant with scientific terms on it. Now, what's very unusual about him is he's also a pioneer in information about aviation. So he's an aviation specialist as early as 1875. This is very interesting to me. And I think we're going to go deep, deep into what is going on here with Dr. Roche. Now, something else I want to say about Dr. Charles Roche is that he got really hung up at a certain point on magic and how it interplayed with science. And he went to all these different sessions with somebody who claimed that they could see through things. It was called, let's see here, the Spaniard with the X-ray eyes. Okay, Joaquin Maria Argamasilla. Fascinating person. But it made him research this very unusual figure who did a magic trick where he could see through anything. And he started to become obsessed because this idea of X-rays was just getting out there. We were just starting to hear about it. And this relates directly to what is happening now. We see people talk about invisibility. Well, if I can see through something, you know, then layers are being lifted. I have X-ray vision, basically. So here's a scientist going into medium sessions, witnessing unusual things. Let's look at some of the, before we get into what he discovers, let's look at some of the sessions he went to, for example. So he's going into these sessions where apparitions are occurring. and he's seeing ectoplasm and these different things. In this regard, here's this famous Italian medium, and she did things like levitate tables. She could move objects, and she's quite remarkable. What happens is he coins the term telekinesis, which means I can move things at a distance with my mind, essentially, and there's no other apparatus that can account for it. It's a reality distortion. It's a disruptor, because we don't expect that in our reality, to be able to look at an object and move it around. So we're getting into this apotheum territory when we're getting around ectoplasm and mediumship. And when we come into telekinesis, you know, basically this guy is saying, look, this is something that's happening. I'm not attributing it to spirits or whatever, but here's what I'd like to see it looked at as a field. This is a field, we'll call it metaphysics instead of traditional physics, and we'll get into exactly what's happening with it. He wrote a book called Our Sixth Sense, and he's often dismissed now, and it's unfortunate, but he had some pretty big hangups, and these go with the period that he was in. A lot of scientists at that time talked about what? Eugenics. And these ideas got picked up by different political groups, and we had all those things that took place. But eugenics was something that was in the air in the period. And so he was the president of the French Eugenics Society, but he was also the president of the Metaphysical Institute. You try to balance those two out. He's a very complex figure. But let's go back to this very unusual thing that he's looking for in the work of these magicians and these mediums. He's looking for something where they can see through, where they have kind of x-ray vision. And he's working closely with this one medium who does that. He runs across this very strange factor. And it's a person who's a great magician and well-known in Paris. And his name is Robert Houdin. And Robert, do you want to give me? Let's hear you say. I love the way you say.
Robert Houdin.
There you go. Now, this particular person had a very interesting trick, where he would stage this very fascinating look through objects that he could look through these different objects, and it was part of a trick that he had. So our friend Dr. Roche became quite fascinated by it, and eventually Houdin would become the root inspiration for someone else that we know quite well, which is Harry Houdini. Now, there's Houdini there, just to give us a little... I think there's something funny about this. They say the world's handcuff king, or, you know, the times have changed. That can mean a lot of things. But what's fascinating is this. When we look back on the posters for what Houdin was doing, these performances, or Robert Houdin, this is the one I really want to specify. Take a good look at that. That is the special X thing, the X performance that our friend Dr. Roche was so curious about. And as we can see down here, there's this X-ray quality to it. They're using this X factor, this X technology, looking through the mind. He's got the hands on there, and they're seeing through things. So we're getting into invisibility around the X. These shows were taking place in through the 1860s, very early periods, utilizing this idea of seeing through things, getting into this whole period. And what would happen eventually is that some of the first X-rays would be developed by Tesla, and we're going into the 1880s, 1890s, and then it becomes a full-fledged thing. Who becomes the X-ray leader? Robert Van de Graaff. Who does he work with? John Trump. It's always X-rays. Eric Compton, who takes over the UFO file. Everything's about X-rays. But we think of X-rays just in one sense of how we can see through things. But actually, X-rays pertain to all sorts of things, including radar, deep space radar. You know, they're obviously associated with different types of healing. So, you know, this idea of just what we understand x-rays to be is very, very limited. In the technological spectrum, it's a gigantic implication. But whatever it was that was going on there, our friend, Dr. Roche, was looking deeply into Robert Houdin, the inspiration for Harry Houdini. He was finding in his magic that key, that door from the metaphysical side into the scientific side. Remember, Dr. Charles Roche is a Nobel Prize winning scientist. Why should he be concerned with mediums? Why should he be concerned with magic tricks? It's something quite remarkable. But what's more remarkable is he's a big influence on Eric Compton. This is what Dr. Roche has to say about his own work to kind of defend it to his colleagues, because they know he's going out and he's doing these incredible things with people like Oliver Lodge and trying to discover the answers to the whole psychic phenomena, life after death, and all the rest of it. Incidentally, Compton believes, yes, there is life after death. It's kind of an unusual thing for a scientist to realize. And he says, well, actually, we've discovered that consciousness is separate from the mind, so that's pretty advanced thinking. Okay, this is Roche's comment from his book preface. Those who expect to find in this book nebulous discussions on human destinies, magic, or theosophy will be disappointed. I've endeavored to write on science, not on dreams, the dreams of science. I've therefore confined myself to a statement of facts and discussion of their actuality, not only with advancing any theory, but scarcely mentioning theories. For all theories as yet proposed to account for metaphysic facts seem to me terribly frail. It is possible or even probable that someday a tenable theory will be formulated, but the time is not yet. For the facts on which the theory could be erected are still in dispute. It's necessary first to establish the facts and to review them in detail as a whole in order to verify the conditions under which they occur. This is our primary duty, our only duty. I can actually work with a scientist like this, because here's somebody who's saying, too many people disagree about it. How can you get a sound science when so many people disagree about it? We have to forget about what the implications of it are and just have to see, study how it works. It's reasonable. He comes up with the three terms: ectoplasm. Materialization is the formation of diverse objects, which in most cases seem to emerge from a human body and take on the semblance of material realities, clothing, veils, sometimes living bodies. Telekinesis, a mechanical action that differs from all known mechanical action being exerted at a distance and without contact on persons or objects under certain determinate conditions. In other words, I can cause something at a distance to change. I can look at an object and make it spin a different way. I can break a mirror. It's all these kinds of things that you see in poltergeist effects. This is what he was witnessing in those medium sessions that we were looking at. This is the corridor. This is where the theosophical scientific branch was going. This is where science was headed. It was the physics part studying in with the metaphysical aspects, the esoteric aspects. This was the great joining of those two things. But what happens is it's public here. When you get about 20 years from this guy, it's gone. They've moved it out. And they've gone into the scientific materialism that takes over. We lose the entire branch of science, the whole other half. And we move into what we have now, which is basically a nonstop mall around things, you know, relating to energy or higher science. It's all this whole thing to serve a marketplace, which is a totally different thing from where these scientists were coming from, even if they were flawed. They're coming from the point of view of some kind of idealism, that the culture is going to move forward. What we got instead was massive secrecy, small group controlling, incredibly advanced technology. And ultimately, the fear of the theosophists coming true, we got our hands on the atomic bomb and used it almost immediately. And this whole thing with all these groups setting the world on fire, from the Nazis to the Japanese to the Soviets, it was, you know, World War II was the Big Bang. So here we have this connection looking back through Compton, through the influence of Compton, who became the person who took over for Vannevar Bush, and he takes over the UFO file. Compton, one of his big influences, is our friend Dr. Riche, who develops metaphysics, develops the term. We use that term all the time. So let's think about that. And this is really where the conversation is going to go and flow for us as we go into the part two of this next Friday. But what I'm hoping right now is that we have Susan Manowich with us. Mm-hmm. Are you there, Susan?
I'm here.
There she is. I see a tree and the sky behind you.
Well, that's a picture of a tree in the sky.
Well, you bring out that nature aspect just by your very presence, let's face it. How are you, Susan?
I'm doing well. It was a little bit of a to-do to get on right now, but I'm on, so hopefully you can hear me well and see me well, and that's a good thing.
We're all excited to see you, actually. Olivia, I know, is a huge fan of yours.
I'm very excited you're here tonight.
Olivia, that's very sweet.
It's been too long.
Oh, it has. It but has. It's been a while. What was that?
Well, you've been up to a lot, as it were.
Yeah, it's been busy, to say the least.
So one of the fantastic things about having you with us tonight is the entire show that we're doing for the X series tonight is based around the idea of the metaphysical aspects that were originally part of the scientific endeavor. So when we get into things later, like the UFO file, all those people we find who were into it, who were part of the Rad Lab and part of the science of the time, all had different backgrounds in things like theosophy or anthroposophy or, you know, Golden Dawn, whatever it happened to be. There was this whole aspect there that gave us an idea that there's the technology and there's the scientific materialism on one side, and then there's this higher reality, and we have to integrate the two. And it seems somewhere along the line, the scientific materialism just glossed over everything. Mm. So this is where we find ourselves. And so you kind of strike me as a figure, just, you know, from the time that we've spent and from the work that you've done for decades, really, you're kind of right. You dance right between those two worlds, because here you are the president of the new energy movement, which is all about breakthrough energy and these, you know, free energy devices in a totally different paradigm. And, but you're right in the very heart of the kind of scientific establishment trying to change their paradigm, change the way they do things. How do you balance it out?
Just by being yourself. How about that? I know that sounds maybe like a silly answer, but I've seemed to straddle these two worlds. You know, when I look at you know, my experiences and maybe how I come into this world and who it's a natural expression to do that. When I took the position at New Energy Movement. And I want to take a couple of moments at some point to comment about that. I found that I needed to have a place to truly be able to express what I felt was the spiritual aspect of these, you know, technologies and the experiences that lead to the creation of them. And it didn't feel when I first entered into this, I can't say position, because, you know, when I say maybe entered this realm of the new energy technology, it didn't feel like there was much space for the spiritual aspect. And I'm not just talking about someone's, you know, day-to-day experience. I mean, even just room for the mysticism and room for a more holistic type of approach to the entire ecosystem that these technologies are maybe birthed in, and definitely how they're held. So for me, it felt like if I don't show up more wholly and fully, then I'm not doing what I've come here to do on the planet.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting because you have such a range of interests. And whenever I get around breakthrough energy, I have to say this, which is I've never found anyone as articulate as you are in describing exactly what we're up against in trying to introduce a different energy paradigm. Very often, it's very abstract to a lot of people. And, you know, we had the wonderful experience, and Olivia remembers this, but you were around for this too. And we were describing it to HBO and they were like, "We really don't understand exactly what breakthrough energy is all about." And I found that so interesting because sometimes we can get kind of into an echo chamber of understanding these things and realize the larger population has very little idea of the things like new energy or free energy or zero point energy, whatever it happens to be. What do you think is the doorway in for an average person into understanding? What's a good, simple way to understand what this is? I mean, people understand solar power, okay.
Right. You know, that's a pretty good question. You know, what for me, sometimes the easiest and most simplest way to explain it isn't very sexy. Because sometimes I think, you know, our culture is very used to sexy and interesting and rad. You know, it depends on who you're talking to. But sometimes, you know, I'd say for the you know, average day-to-day person, I describe it as technology that's more in alignment with nature. It's doing more good than harm. And people seem to understand that a little bit more easily. It's like, oh, okay. So, you know, and they'll usually ask, are you talking about solar? Are you talking about, you know, wind? And it's like, no, it's actually, it's a little bit different than that. You know, and you start to maybe talk about, you know, spiral dynamics and something that people can relate to, again, as it relates to nature. And depending upon, again, who the person is, sometimes I'll just say it's kind of like alien technology. You know, I say that as a way to be cheeky, but they're like, oh, I get that, because there's so much now, you know, in the media and in video games and cartoons even. So, you know, I'll sometimes explain it at that. So it's also, you know, knowing your audience and how you want to describe it. But if they're a little bit more open-minded as you're getting into, you know, discussing that it's a little bit more in alignment with nature, then you start to talk about subtle energy. And, you know, people seem to relate a little bit more, you know, to it from that perspective. And then obviously talking about some of the science as it relates to it. It's not getting, you know, you don't want to get into arguments with people if people are not, you know, getting it. It's like, it's okay. It's maybe not meant to be. But, you know, if there's an opening there, you can begin to explain it. And
no, they have to get it. I mean, that's, come on. They just have to get it now.
I don't know about that. I think I'm giving up on people that don't want to get it. It's like, I don't know if that's
the alien aspect is nothing very foreign for you. You've spent a lot of time examining the whole field. You've worked with some of the best people in it, including John Mack when he was doing really radical, having a really radical technique as a Harvard professor looking into this. You just wrote, contributed to a chapter in a book put out by Free. So maybe that's kind of an interesting way for us to get into this.
Sure. Yeah, I did. That was a lot of years in the making. seriously, this was 25 years in the making, because the story goes this way. So, you know, when we say, people say, like, Daniel, you introduced me as working with John Mack. Let's be real. I was like this little 21-year-old student who had just graduated my degree in psychology from a college in Massachusetts, you know, my bachelor's degree. And I actually did a semester of graduate school as well. I went right in and did that, but I was like, oh, this is boring. I need to do something else. And lo and behold, it was Bud Hopkins that actually introduced me to John and said, hey, I think that you'd be really great helping this group out because they're doing research right now, and they're funded to do research on people that have had these, you know, different type of encounters. And so, you know, little old me at 21 years old is thinking, I'm going to help them figure out their research studies because I'm really interested in understanding the physics and scientific downloads that come in and occur. And because that was some of the information that I was getting. And no, I'm not someone who understands what I would call physics from a traditional standpoint, or math, or even geometry. But I'm someone who's, you know, gotten some of this type of information. So I said, geez, if I'm getting this, then who else is getting this type of information? And so that's one of the things that I wanted to research. And, you know, they kind of looked at me and thought, oh, well, that's all nice and well, but we want to research you. You know, we want you to be a part of this study of, you know, people that we're interviewing to, you know, really begin to get a better understanding of, you know, the nature of intelligence and cognition and, you know, all of these other things that they were researching as part of the contactee experience. So and that never left me, you know, I was still hungry for understanding the collective contactee experience as it related to these downloads. And, you know, for me, I wanted to understand, hey, if I'm getting this, then what is everybody else getting? I'm just one person here. So what is everybody else getting? And no, I'm not, and I'll use the word egotistical. I'm not egotistical enough to think my experiences are the only thing and it's the truth. You know, I'm one piece of this thing. So part of the free group, which is the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters, in I think it was 2013, Dr. Edgar Mitchell and Dr. Rudy Shield from the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and he was a colleague of Dr. John Max, and actually is a mentor of mine, I would call.
And Rudy Dr. Mitchell, of course, is an Apollo astronaut who went to the moon. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes. So they got together and there was this man, Ray Hernandez. I don't know how they all, you know, eventually came together, but they did. And they said, okay, let's start to get some data here and let's start to get some research on these contactees and let's try to further understand what's actually happening and going on. Because after John had passed away, I think that was in 2004 or 2005,
John Max.
Research.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that research stopped. And then, you know, as you and I have talked about before, and as I said publicly a little while ago, you know, it was almost like after John died, there wasn't good information about what was happening as it related to these encounters with people. And, you know, from what I recall, I thought John was doing a pretty good job. From what I understand, he had met with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and there was also some dialogues that were taking place to further and actually know one of the people that introduced John to more of the indigenous ways that, to some of the indigenous people and their leaders that understood a different framework other than that Western-minded framework of how to look at this experience, right? So, and he was
and
on
a Western thing might be like, you know, let's look at it and say like, oh, there's a crashed saucer. Let's go retrieve it, get high technology. And that's a very Western kind of way of looking at it. He's looking at it and he's saying there's all these almost shamanic implications. There's a whole evolutionary spiritual implication of these things showing up in people's lives.
Yes. And yeah. He also was beginning, I believe, and again, I wasn't around this man every day, so I can't comment, but from what I could see from some of the readings and some of the people that had known him well, is that he was understanding that there's an ecological connection to these experiences, meaning what we're doing to the planet and our relationship to the environment. And that to me was one of the big things that I pulled out of the book Passport to the Cosmos, you know, when I eventually read it, because it was something that struck me as a truth, you know, as something that was important. So getting back onto this research, you know, many years went by and you know, I get a phone call and I'm asked, you know, would you help and be a part of this this research to help construct some questions? Because I know that this is a passion of yours with the new energy technology and, you know, the new physics and the new math. And would you help us construct the study? And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, 20 some odd years later, here we go. We get a chance to finally do this.
Wow, that's interesting. You, when I say you worked with John Mack or with Edgar Mitchell, it's funny because a lot of people know them from books. A lot of people know about breakthrough energy ideas from books, from reading Nikola Tesla books. I read those books and I'm in the same boat.
Yeah.
You know, you knew the people. You were around them. You spoke to them, you interacted with the programs that they were engaged in. On the new energy front, you'll go out and you'll meet inventors. You'll go meet people and talk to them about their free energy devices. how there's a different level there than being kind of an armchair researcher, which we've seen a lot of. What is it? What is the core thing first that people like John Mack and Edgar Mitchell were trying to tell us in relation to this other reality, one, and the energetic possibilities, two? And then just in terms of people who have this kind of book version of this stuff versus your actual experience, what's the difference?
Well, that's a fantastic question. And let me start by trying to remember what you said.
You can start with Edgar and John.
I'm going to do that. I spent time with John, obviously. And I was a kid. And I say that I was a kid because I wasn't, 30 and already married and, had a house and a child and things like that.
Let's start with why you would talk to John. Why did you go see John?
Because I thought I could help. I wasn't in need of counseling or psychological help because part of the group that they offered was a therapy type of a group. And I remember when I first went in there, I felt a heaviness and I said, this isn't my thing. I'm interested in understanding more of where people are at. I don't feel like a victim here, so I don't know why I'm doing this part. I really kept going more towards the researchers and trying to, what I call move the needle forward. It was, I even had at 21 years old, I even had this really intense need to have the research at that point go further versus, because I knew somehow even back then it wasn't about me and my ego and me feeling like a victim because I feel alone in this world because I've had these experiences. It was like, I've got something to do here.
Oh, yeah.
And let's get on with figuring out what that to do is. So what led me to spend time and energy there was, there was no place for me to put this. And, here I am having these encounters and here I am getting, this information about the nature and structure of the cosmos. And and I'm 21. Where do you put that in the 1990s other than, going to like Lollapalooza and dancing and trying to get at some angst at that moment because, you look at the world around you and it's like, oh, I can't really talk to anybody about this, right? Mm-hmm. So, that really became my, my secret of what I was doing because I had a job in Boston and I worked and but on at night and on the weekends I was going to these meetings and I was talking with people and understanding, listening to Dr. Scheel try to figure out how these beings came from one dimension to the next and what does that really mean, which led him to eventually develop I believe with Edgar Mitchell the quantum hologram theory, which is featured in the Beyond UFOs book. So what led me to being with some of these people, and by the way, I met Ed Mitchell once, so again, I want to be accurate, and spent a good 6 hours in the car with him and drove him back from a meeting in Maine to Boston and had just like this amazing one-on-one time with him. But my colleagues also spent quite a bit of time with Dr. Mitchell as well. So they're older and obviously they're older than me at the time, and there's a knowledge, a wisdom, and a deep truth that some of these people seem to carry, which is tremendously, tremendously valuable, at least for my education and my knowledge. And I think how I try to look at some of the other people that I work with now.
What would you say, if you had to summarize briefly what John Mack, where he was coming from, what his conclusions were, Professor John Mack, around the UFO file, around the UFO subject, and Dr. Edgar Mitchell, and how similar they were, but in your own words, what were their conclusions?
Okay, I'd be speculating because I wasn't with them upon their exit of this plane of existence. But I do know this. I do know that they wanted the research to continue. that they wanted to understand that getting the information out was really critical and it was very important. So understanding that collective contactee experience was something that was very important, and to dive deeper in there. And you know, to me, the evolution of this work now is here. You know, we have it now. It's taken a long time, but now we have it. And I know Dr. Mitchell was interested in technology. He was very interested in working towards getting these technologies to be worked on.
Yes.
And I asked him a specific question. I said to him, I said, well, Dr. Mitchell, at what point do these people, whomever they are, the powers that be, come after you? He said, oh, well, that's when you can really disrupt, you know, the status quo in terms of money. He said, that's when they start to become a little agitated and want to come after you.
That's when they roll out the TTSA, basically. Well, this is an interesting point, actually, because we're at a level, we're at a crossroads in time, because you're right that a lot of this stuff has now become out there and a lot of it's available. This book you mentioned, Beyond UFOs, I think is a kind of a breakthrough also. So we'll talk about that more and your chapter in it. But really, the large scale picture, the kind of noise factor has been high around things like To the Stars Academy. It was a very CIA controlled operation, and I've done a number of programs on it here. I don't want you to, you don't have to comment on them so much, but this idea that there's this stream side by side, this kind of caricature of the real research that came out of people like Mitchell, that came out of people like Dr. Mack, who were really looking for, you know, in Mitchell's case, he actually was leaning toward the technology, talking about this breakthrough energy aspect. In Mack's case, it's yep. consciousness as well. But that's very different from the kind of weird things that we're seeing with like these guys putting out promo videos and being like, dude, we have metamaterials. And like, look, this CIA guy from the Bush administration is on our side. You know, it's a very kind of creepy stream coming into all this. How do you deal with it?
Yeah.
How do you move your own stuff forward?
Well, the irony.
we lost your screen there. Are you back?
There
we go.
Can you see me?
Now you're good.
All right.
Beautiful.
Don't know what's going on. Let's get to it, because that's a really important question.
Okay. I lost your signal a little bit, Susan. Can you hear me okay?
Here's what I thought.
Susan, I think we lost you. I think we lost the signal. Okay. I think we lost your signal, but I think if you want to try to come back in, to try to dial back in, I'm thinking that's the way to go, because I can't hear you. It's okay. I should say that you're in Toronto and we have kind of a crisscross going on with that. Sometimes with Canada, that will happen. So I've lost their signal for now, but she's going to try it back. She's going to try to dial back in. One of the things I want to say about Susan is she does such remarkable work, and she has such a remarkable history around this. And she's never been somebody who's really sought the spotlight, but my God, this is somebody who goes around the world working on the ground for this, trying to get to the bottom of the breakthrough energy aspect, and just doing a whole lot of development around this. So it's quite remarkable. Hey, there you are. Can you hear me?
Okay, hopefully this works. I'm sorry. I can hear you.
Okay. I'm still, I think that you're faint again. I wonder if you shouldn't just restart
Daniel?
That and come back in. Hey, there you are.
All right. Okay. If it doesn't connects, I will stop and hang and go back, and I'm totally sorry.
No, it's not your fault. This is just connection. No, we just want to make sure you get the right connection so that we hang on your every word. You understand, Susan? This is what's going on.
But it's annoying for people when they're watching. So I'm
Yeah, sure. No, it's no problem at all. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to recommend that you close out of the session and come back in and try it. Maybe you'll come in on a different signal for it. So I would just restart it and catch a different signal and come right back in. Right. We'll be here. We'll be waiting for you. Okay. Yes, beautiful. My God. I would say this, that it's remarkable. And I do highly recommend this book that just came out called Beyond UFOs, which comes into this question around consciousness and the UFO file. This is the crucial aspect. This is what John Mack was getting at. The reason that Mack was such a threat to the establishment was he was raising it out. You know, there weren't any dancing galactic ambassadors. There were no phony CIA guys up there saying, I've got a metamaterial. You know, this was the real thing. And Dr. Mitchell, I mean, he'd done so many, you know, he'd actually been in space. This is an actual astronaut. For him to come back and be in charge of this whole meditation institution, it was quite remarkable. So these are very different. It's a very different strain there. And I plugged into that very early. I had the pleasure, because I had a friend who worked for Mack. It was a total fluke. I had the pleasure of meeting Mack and spending time with him. And, you know, what I got from his work was that he was really after something totally different. He wanted to get the whole UFO file question to a different level, where we would understand it's a cultural, spiritual phenomena, as opposed to, you know, this whole kind of Roswellian thing, let's get the craft and redevelop it and make a bigger spaceship. That really wasn't what he was going for. And this is what's so amazing, because that's what Susan's work is all about. And, you know, so much of her work, she has another book that's coming out in the fall, and we're going to be tracking with Susan all through the fall. So even if we don't get her back tonight, it's going to be remarkable. But in the meantime, Miss Olivia, how are you doing? Wasn't it great to have her comment on that?
I mean, I actually think some people didn't quite understand who Susan is and why she's important. So could you go into her background a little bit more?
No. Yeah, I did. I have, actually.
She's a bigwig. She's important. Just because she's beautiful doesn't mean she's not powerful and brilliant.
Listen,
and
it's kind of like, you know, don't hold it against me, because I'm
exactly
understand.
And is there a link where, you know, where would people go to find out more about her work?
Well, she's gonna get into that. I think she's just rejoined the program, actually. Are you there, Susan?
I'm here.
This must sound like just the most rollicking, crazy conversation behind the scenes.
I hope you weren't talking about me, but.
No, absolutely. No, one of the things I was pointing out, actually, was this whole thing about that you have this background of going into these things, and actually it's a very visceral experience. And I like to get that combination with you, because a lot of people are book smart around it. You understand the whole kind of intellectual aspect and exercise, but you have a very visceral engagement, visceral thing with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's,
yes,
for me, that's an important factor.
Well, thanks. It's been a lot of work. You know, it's funny. I don't think people understand necessarily, you know, this is it. One, it's, I would say it's not easy to follow what you feel like you're here to do, this mission. And at the same time, it looks so, you know, it's so convoluted. It should have been easier, right? Like, oh, we're gonna do this research, or help people understand, you know, the nature of it may be a greater reality, and the fact that, hey, you know, planets probably suffering a bit, and we're probably going through some planetary changes. So, you know, we really need to adjust the way that we do things. Like, we're here to help, right? And you know, whoever thought it would be met with such incredible hardship?
Right. Absolutely.
Right. I mean, it's kind of wonky. And, you know, you were talking about the other group that's doing what they're doing. And what I was saying earlier is, you know, people that have high awareness, they're not easily, I don't want to say fooled, but they don't easily go to that. What I find is more of an old school mentality that, you know, it's like, even though we're talking about UFOs, ETs, and this technology, you know, it's an old school mentality in terms of the approach that's being taken, because it's not in the new consciousness. It's not in the new awareness. It's a bit in what I call this rogue, you know, type of mentality that, with all due respect, is it's kind of outdated. It's old school and not a hip way.
Right, right. And this is the whole kind of big push that we see around. I call it really the kind of marketing of UFOs is really what you're getting at here. It's that marketing of this whole approach, which really has this, like, sign up for the t-shirt now.
Yeah, you know, and hey, t-shirts aren't a bad thing if they look good and they feel good. But I think what John was really getting to, and this is something that I actually said earlier today, and I want to repeat it. You know, there's a divinity in these experiences. This is not like, you know, ET or UFO that is meant to be, you know, splashed on a screen and meant to be bastardized or sexualized or whateverized. You know, these are very divine experiences that people are having, and they have a significant impact on them that are lifelong. And the vast majority of people that have these encounters, they are changed in a way that they show up as a more whole human being, and they feel like they've got a job here to help with this transition. And, you know, most of the times it's not just an ET encounter. You know, what we found from our research is that, you know, people are seeing humanoid beings, they're seeing astral type beings, energy beings, human looking beings. And it's not just like in the realm of, you know, ET, that kind of, there's something much actually happening and going on here. And only when you actually do some legit research can you see this wider spectrum that's happening and going on. But, you know, it does seem to be related to, you know, what I would call divinity. A step further, like you've been talking about Rudolf Steiner, there is a moral component to how people are shifted from these encounters. And that's the stuff that cannot be, you know, marketed and sold and put in a funky little package to make it, you know, look edgy and cool. Because, geez, if that's the case, we probably, well, maybe some people would be running to it.
Well, it's interesting. It's a great point, actually. The ethics aspect is quite interesting. This isn't something that comes up very often. But, of course, the idea really is, you know, is the culture ready to make that move? Is the culture, you know, ready to accept something on an ethical basis in order to move forward? Like, this came up very much during the whole conversation about the atomic bomb. We started this whole episode off looking at the Rad Lab, which was the Manhattan Project that became the group that managed the UFO file, the same scientists. A lot of those guys had their own sense of vision. They had some kind of an ethical basis for it. It seems like over time, as things like the UFO files slipped into the aerospace corridor, it became something totally different, just a group obsessed with secrecy and domination, which is a very different thing.
Right, right. It is a different thing. And there's nothing, you know, nothing. And I'm going to hold up this big fat book because I've been reading this, because even though I've done my chapter on
that's,
it,
that's beyond still everybody else.
Yeah, this is a thick book. You know, there's very little information that actually there's no information in here that says that, you know, with this technology or the creation of it, that we need to dominate, weaponize, and, you know, become more ruthless beings. If anything, it's the complete opposite, that we need to be in a greater state of collaboration, sharing, harmony, caring of other people, and develop technologies with nature that are more in alignment with harmony to truly help, you know, this transition that we're in, but also to get to, you know, a more evolved state. And, you know, when I look at some of these other groups and I look at, you know, the masses as a whole, I don't worry so much about everybody anymore. What I look at is the good people that are showing up, and the people that I call have really fought that hero's journey, because there's inventors, scientists, engineers, there's people that feel like they have a calling to help in this arena. There's intuitives and psychics and mathematicians and lawyers, even, you know, there's people that medical doctors that feel that, you know, that they have a calling to do something different. You know, for me at this point, it's for those people that are actually showing up, that know that there's a different way to move about this and go about this. So there's actually more of these type of people than you would expect.
Yeah, absolutely. Your chapter in the book, what is it about?
The chapter in the book is about the messages gleaned from the scientific technical downloads that contactees get. And where it came from, I hate misquoting even my own research. I'd rather be accurate. This question came because there was phase one of the free research study. There's a total of, I believe, three phases to the research. And they 2,477 people responded to this question. And here is the question in phase one. Do you believe that you possess information about advanced technology, advanced physics, or other scientific information that you've never read or learned about in your normal environment? And Daniel, I'll ask you, what do you think the percentage that said yes was?
I think it would be higher than people would imagine at first.
Okay, so you're an astute man. What do you think it is?
I'd lean pretty high. I'd lean into the 60%.
Okay, well, you're an optimistic dark journalist. So I'd give you a little high, but 41%.
That's so, really.
40%. Yeah, it actually is. You know, it is. That's kind of a high percentage of people, right? You know, because when you think about it, you know, ask average people. What do you feel your knowledge? How do you feel your advanced knowledge of physics and sciences? You know, the average person would probably say, no. You know, I know very little. I know nothing. So Maybe in comparison to the average population, you know, that is actually an extremely high number, but 41% of those people said yes. And so from that question, we entered into phase three of this study, which I helped to construct with a whole bunch of other PhD researchers, a lot smarter than I am. And we asked students, and I won't go through all eight of those. I'll go through the two, you know, to me that are extremely important, which is, okay, so what is the nature of this contact? What is it about? And answers on that information.
What is the nature of the content?
What is the nature of the information? What's the nature of the contact? Basically, what is happening and what's occurring? And again, this stuff you can get in the free book. And no, I'm not making any money off of it. Just letting people know that this blood, sweat, and tears is mostly free as it relates to this stuff.
Free is a little more descriptive than you want it to be.
Yeah, exactly. So. You know, here's one of the things that came up is that with the nature of information, 20% of the people getting information about the nature of the universe, they're getting cosmology, they're getting that the universe is a living system. They're getting these scientific and technical downloads about how the universe works and how energy propagates in the universe and how they're a part of it as well. So they're being taught, you know, this information. They're also being shown consciousness education training. So they're getting education outside of their normal day-to-day environment, either when they go to sleep or they, you know, sometimes are taken upon ships as well, which, you know, begs the question, what really is a ship? You know, maybe what we think it is not necessarily what it really is, which, you know, I think would require further research and understanding.
What do you think is the strangest, I want to wrap this into your question thing, so I'll make it a quick one, but what do you think is the strangest characteristics they share in common? What's the thing that really stands out?
There's a transition on the planet based on what we're seeing for research, which everyone's like, oh, it's obvious there's a transition, but no, many of these people are being prepared for a transition on the planet to assist other people during this shift. They're helping, and they feel a strong compulsion at 90 to 95% to actually share their information and to help others the way that they feel that some of these beings, and I won't say ETs because some of them are energy beings, the way that some of these beings are sharing this information with them. So it's almost like, you know, the energy being is teaching, training, working with the person. And then the person here, you know, on this plane of existence on earth is working with family, friends, you know, maybe some people in their community, maybe some people that they work with. So, you know, they're feeling a sense of, and it's not a frantic assistance. It's actually coming from a loving place, which is another large component that comes up in this research. They're also being shown and taught about ship creation and ship navigation, which, you know, it was one of the top three that were on here.
Wow.
And so again, you ask, why is that important? I don't want to make any conclusions because I think it's premature, but there's something that is happening and there's something that's going on and it's important to pay attention to, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Is there, you know, when thinking about the experiences that these people have and the way that the government tracks the UFO file, what's the difference, really?
To me, the difference is that, and I was talking with another inventor the other day about this stuff, because, you know, we try to really understand it. You know, I think that the people that are getting this information directly, there's a divine connection that exists. There's a divine connection that's there. And it's not all about the creepy, you know, ET story. There's very little information that comes up in any of this research, you know, that shows that there's, you know, what I call the creepy story. Is it a small percentage? Yes. Somewhere between like 5 and 9%. And, you know, then that begs further research as well, right? But it seems to be that the powers that be are, that they're tracking, you know, people that are having, you know, this type of contact and tracking groups that have original information. So it's almost like this information is coming in and people are either creating devices, they're working with others, you know, they're getting this, what I call original creative information. And then you've got these other groups that are coming in, you know, co-opting emails, co-opting websites and co-opting, you know, even names of companies and coming up with.
Let's say that these are marketing groups that are funded by government groups, covert groups.
Sure, probably.
I mean, that's, you know, it seems to be obvious, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, as I keep saying, I'm not so worried about it, because what I see is that the astuteness on behalf of the consciousness rising so quickly that it's almost like you can see who's lesser original and who's actually more original. And there does seem to be what I call something baked in the cake with how the universe and all this stuff works. And I don't understand it. And I don't claim to understand it, that these technologies are not going to necessarily work, or we're not going to necessarily always know the answer to what is actually happening and going on. And even though these groups maybe profess that, you know, I've said this before, that they're your daddy and they know better, you know, they may profess that and know that, but we don't know. And that's the irony. And you asked me, well, what else struck me about what people were saying? And here's one of the things that struck me. This is why I think that, you know, the cosmos and all this divine information, the information that comes in, is super, super savvy. It's almost like it understood the games that are played on this planet.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, we figured it out. So here's what we're going to do instead. They over and over and over said, we'll know when the time is right. Geez, I get these downloads. I don't know what to do with them. And when I tell the being, or when I ask my higher self, I get the same answer. You'll know when the time is right. You'll know what to do when the time is right. Over and over and over and over and over. And I also read ahead in my book, and one of the other chapters in the back had to do with human to human interaction and how we need to be better to each other as humans. But also there's a component in there on the ecological, you know, messages that come in, and it's the same thing. You know, there's the same type of information in there that, you know, we'll know when the time is right, that there's something that will be released in these people when the time, whenever that time is, happens. And does it have to do with an energetic shift? Does it have to do with an event on the planet? You know, what does it have to do with? I don't know. And neither do really any of them. You know, some people have some answers, but there wasn't something that I would say was uniquely consistent enough that we can say, oh yes, all of these people are saying this. And so, you know, what that says to me is there's also a co-creative process that's at play here with all of this.
Absolutely. Well, they're suggesting that you'll know innately, as if, you know, don't worry, your intuition is going to take care of it. That's kind of fascinating, actually, when I think about it. When you hear, and when we're in this space, and actually I'm going to take this opportunity to suggest, because we're going to go into a QA section here, so when people throw their questions out to Olivia, make sure the questions are in caps so she knows which ones to catch. And you're watching Dark Journalists, take your time, go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for the newsletter so we stay in touch. And we're here with Susan Manowich, who is the president of New Energy Movement. And, you know, she's an incredible author. Her chapter in this book, Beyond UFOs, something that just came out associated with this free group, which is the original Dr. Edgar Mitchell Foundation. Absolutely incredible stuff. You need to get kind of into this, you know, strain, this pattern, this kind of wave that's coming in here. And Susan Manowich, her work is right in the heart of it. Now, Susan, one of the things I want to ask you is, we hear about the Space Force. The Space Force is right in the heart of all the questions that are coming up. We have all these battles around technology, talking about new bureaucracies, weaponizing of space. So on one hand, these people are hearing things like, you'll know what to do when the time is right. There is cause for concern just in the general population and looking at this situation, especially people who are aware of things like the UFO file. How do you think this is playing out? What is the Space Force all about? What's going on?
You know, I guess they're playing the role that they feel like they're supposed to be playing right now. I mean, what can I say? There's nothing in the research that discusses and talks about that. It's almost like people are not being shown to be bothered with it, that spend your time and energy. And, you know, this might sound like what I call hokey dokey, you know, spiritual woo woo stuff, but.
Is it hokey dokey or hokey dokey? I need to know the difference between them.
It could be hokey pokey. I don't know. But the sense of what comes with this information is constantly about being calm, being open in your heart, and feeling love and feeling connection. It is extremely important. It is, again, baked in the cake with a lot of these pieces of information that come in. You know, you don't find that the beings are just instilling this information without some type of, you know, feeling of love and oneness and interconnection. And, you know, what you just brought up is not that. So it doesn't seem like, you know, this population is bothered with it. And, you know, I know, as you were talking about so many of these different, you know, great inventors, and there's an awareness that these inventors have about, you know, the isness of what is happening and going on. It doesn't stop them from creating, you know, devices that will help us through this shift, whatever this shift, you know, may end up being, to have our energy sovereignty. So if anything, they're feeling more compelled to do it. So I don't find people, you know, being too hung up on all of the other stuff that these groups and organizations are doing. And you know, maybe that's a good thing, because if they were, then maybe it would prevent them, you know, from being able to be in that, you know, divine creative space that, you know, many of them seem to be in as they are doing what they're doing. It's like they have an awareness about it, but they're not, you know, so caught up in it. And, you know, even for myself, I think if I was to spend so much time and energy thinking about that, it would distract me from creating what I know I'm here to create.
Oh, absolutely. It's fascinating. You know, the idea is this, basically. Well, first, what I want to know is your thoughts on, you know, does this idea of ETs, off-world civilizations, the UFO file, does it have anything to do with Breakthrough Energy, or is that a connection that we've made independently out there just over time? People saying, yeah, if you get the UFO answer, you'll get the Breakthrough Energy answer. Is that true?
Well, we have to define, you know, what the UFO answer is. Here's what I know for me, and it's for my little piece of this world, for someone who's had, you know, contact and someone who is working actively in this arena, that, you know, to me, what is the UFO or ET connection? What is it really? You know, for me, it's been about morality. It's been about ethics. It's been about listening to my intuition, you know, here and here and here. And it's been about following, you know, these guidelines and these signals to move about things more efficiently and faster. And it's also been about a balance between the yin and the yang, that you really cannot entirely do this thing well and right if it's what I call the cart before the horse. And here is what, you know, we found. As I said, I was asked to run this organization in 2017. And if you go look on the website, there's nothing that's really changed in a while. And people will say, well, you know, you're moving too slow. And, you know,
this is New Energy Movement.
Yeah, New Energy Movement. People say, you know, moving too slow.
Right. Tell us what it is for a moment.
Sure. New Energy Movement was started by Dr. Brian O'Leary about 15 years ago. And Joel Garbin was running the organization for quite a long time. A really good man, really good human being. And he asked me to take over in January of 2017. So, you know, I did all the things that you're supposed to do at first. And then, I mean, I really got into it and visited when basically all over the world, met with a lot of different inventors, saw a lot of different devices, ended up partnering with a really fantastic vetter who is a solid human being. And we started to really dig deep, and we were coming up with the same thing over and over. And I'll tie this into the ET, you know, connection. Because it's not just about ET. It's such a silly term that we use at times. Because again, we really are just beginning to understand what it all really means. Because most organizations would never even touch the term ET because it just had, you know, such a silly, you know, reputation with it, right? So we avoid it. But you know, here's what we found. We found that the inventor-investor cycle and the dynamic that was there was just set up constantly for failure. It didn't work because inevitably the vast majority of investors would not honor their word, and they would not you know, allow this, you know, creative control on behalf of the inventors. And then the inventors wouldn't honor, you know, what they were doing, because, you know, sometimes you had to get through, and it wasn't with all of them, but sometimes you had to get through the hero complex. Like, my device is going to save the entire world and it's worth $500 million. And yes, that's a true story.
So this is interesting, actually, because people always assume, you know, well, the deep state is going to snuff it out. The deep state and different types of groups have done a lot to suppress energy developments. We know that that's true. But you're saying there's also kind of a human folly aspect here, which is people individually that they're causing the issues. They're not cooperating.
Listen, in this field. It's not their fault entirely, because it's like this. I mean, I spent a lot of years doing emotional intelligence training, consulting, leadership development consulting, you know, management development, organizational development stuff. And you know, what I know about from my experiences with contact, that it's truly about, you know, getting deep and understanding the root of where someone is coming from and why. And how is that relating to our betterment of Earth and humanity? I mean, those are, you know, really like the value system that's there. And Steiner called it moral technology. And that is,
it's a great phrase.
It is a great phrase. And I'll tell you a little story about that in a moment. So, you know, there's more what I would call human to human issues that are here than it is as simple as, well, can't we just develop a device and can't we just get it out? No, the whole ecosystem needs to be different. And that is what we are now working on. And, you know, soon we'll be able to come out with more of what we're doing. But the ecosystem is incredibly important to hold all this well and right, to make sure that the inventors, with all due respect, do not get screwed, and to make sure that the investor is not having some secret things, you know, happening and going right on well in the back end. So when you look at the roots of what is being developed and how it's being supported from a business standpoint, a legal standpoint, you know, an R&D standpoint, even a distribution or manufacturing standpoint, or even if it's safe for the environment. I mean, the whole ecosystem actually is what is needing to
so you're saying developing the ecosystem is worth the effort. It's worth the time. It's not a kind of thing that you can get in an impatient, I want breakthrough energy and disclosure right now kind of mindset.
Exactly. And, you know, when you think about it, it is the most worthy endeavor to do, because if we are talking about something that, like, I think we're used to, you know, our day and age that we get things quick, right? Like, where's my bulletproof coffee when I want it?
Yeah, right, right.
Like, I should be able to just find it. Why is it taking me an hour and a half to get there? You know, we want things quick. And, you know, the term morality is one thing. And then you take technology, right? And you put those together, and we expect that it's just immediately going to happen without people having to drop, you know, stories and drop an attachment that they have to what maybe they think that this is supposed to be and how it's supposed to look. And if we're truly listening to a new way of doing this and a new way of showing up, it takes time, it takes energy, it takes collaboration, it takes clean funding to come into play. And it takes people being able to show up in their wholeness and fullness, and not as this, you know, wishy-washy term, but really genuinely being able to show up in their soul's mission. And, you know, to me, there's nothing, I can't say there's nothing more sad, but it makes me very sad when I see the inventors that have such high consciousness, such love for this earth, in such, they've been beaten down many, many times, and they keep getting up, and they keep getting up, and they keep getting up, and, you know, brushing off the wounds and brushing off the battles. And you know what, you know, we're doing it for them. We're doing it so, you know, they don't have to go through this and experience being shafted again and being, you know, taken again, because they have a legit mission here. And, you know, how does it relate to the contactee experience? Well, I will say this. There's contactees that have very critical pieces of information that do need to be connected in with some of these different scientists, engineers, and inventors. And this collaborative aspect is what is seeming to come through. And collaboration requires us to drop, you know, more of our ego in order to do that. And in saying we don't have all the answers, and I'm not the only one who knows how to do X, Y, Z. And it takes, you know, I don't like the term investor, but it takes someone who is willing to contribute funds in a very clean, healthy way without that, you know, draconian energy or Babylonian energy attachment to it.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a terrible corporate environment that we're in 2018 here. You know, I mean, the answer that they come up with very often to workers' conditions in Apple's case is suicide nets for their employees who feel overworked. So that gives you an idea of where their mentality is regarding, you know, labor versus capital there. It's a complete imbalance. You mentioned Steiner there. I've got a quote for you, which is a Steiner quote from 1916. Where he says, all we can do is try to gain a clear picture of the situation and really live with that knowledge. We must remember that thoughts are actual dynamic forces. All we can do now is think matters through clearly. Living with these true thoughts for just 2 days before being drawn in again by the black magic of journalism will make a difference. And the time might come when we can use this to bring something about or get someone else to do something. It locks in very well with what you're talking about.
Yeah, Steiner, I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible, the relationship. And you gave me a quote about the 100 years, and I don't remember it specifically, but I know you're much better at that than I am. Do you remember
Oh, that's a theme throughout all these X episodes, which is Steiner's quote, which is in 1916, when everywhere he turned, and Germany was in the middle of World War One, you know, France, all these different countries were involved. And he said, you know, I honestly, if anthroposophy doesn't make it through now, if the mystery schools don't make their stand now, there's going to be this opportunity. It'll come up in a 20-year window, 100 years from now, which would take us through 2016 to 2036 to bring forward the esoteric aspects for the larger population. And that's the window that we're in right now.
Yeah, well, it's happening.
You can feel it. Yeah, you can definitely feel it.
I see it, you know, I see it with whom we deal with and whom we're interacting with. And some people are done. You know, there's people that are still playing the games, but there's other people, they're done. They're done with the traditional investor, inventor model. They're done with, you know, feeling like so-and-so is going to benefit and it's not going to go to the earth and it's not going to go to humanity as a whole. And they're tired of that. That's something that they're tired of because they have a mission here and they need to complete it.
Wow.
So yeah, that fits in alignment. It's and they're firm on it. There's a firmness that's there. The Constitution is strong.
Well, you're bringing forward something here, which I find really fascinating. Let's do this. Let's turn the floor over to Olivia. Miss Olivia, how are your questions doing over there?
Okay. Let's focus on Susan's questions. I'm just gonna rattle off a bunch of them.
Please okay? do. So we're gonna do Susan's. You're ready for questions. The whole crowd that's here has submitted a number of questions along this line. So we're going to kind of rifle a few questions at you.
Okay, so JJK is asking, has Susan ever had a UFO experience?
Yes.
Would you go into that?
Oh, yeah, well, so I guess, yeah. Okay, go ahead, Daniel.
I think that you can say, you know, basically a quick outline, which is, this is something I know from knowing you, which is, this happens since childhood, pretty much.
Yeah, I came in. Yes, I had my first physical encounter when I was about 5 years old. But previous to that, I had meaning in the womb, and then some had conscious memory of a connection to, let's put it this way, the non-physical world. So it wasn't weird and unusual when I had my first encounter with. And I wouldn't call it a UFO. I would call it, it was like a checkup and a reconnection to make sure things were going on track here as they're supposed to, in a very loving, in a very loving way.
Wow, that's fascinating. That whole aspect of your experience and your knowledge is a very interesting balance against all your work and emotional intelligence, breakthrough energy, you know, so you can kind of dance in a lot of different worlds. I always find that interesting about you. What else have you got?
Cheryl Peterson wants to know, were you at the seance after John Mack's death?
No, I wasn't. My daughter was young at the time. She was around two and a half years old. And I know that there were people that I know that were there. And I remember hearing some pieces of information about it. But no, I wasn't there for that. I did have a dream about John 6 months after he passed away, which led me to actually getting my butt out to a meeting afterwards and then reconnecting with some people that he worked with that I now spend, you know, I've spent the last 15 years communicating with, or 13 years.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's interesting with John, too, because he caused a ripple in so many different areas. I think his work has that feel to it, which is it's breakthrough stuff. You know, that it's almost like people, a number of people I know, shape their entire opinion about the subject just from his work. You know, they didn't have the whole Roswell background. They didn't have all these different kinds of things about it. So it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
I do want to say about John Mack, I've always been curious about this. His unusual death in the UK after giving this conference, have you ever found anything unusual about that?
Of course, yeah. I mean, what I found unusual about it was, because I think I've mentioned this in other interviews, some of the experiences that I had, let's put it this way, with agencies when I was younger. And then when I was a part of that group, I had felt that our group was followed. And I'm not a paranoid person. And other members of the group felt that we were followed as well. So it was always like this weird awareness of trying to understand what was going on from these contact experiences, still trying to live your life like a normal human being, getting married and having children and going to, you know, finish degrees and working. I mean, it's like trying to, you know, really process and understand, what's really going on here. And when he passed away, it was a big shock to, you know, me and to others. And because it felt like something was wrong. It felt like something turned wrong here. And I know everything's always perfect and it's in its alignment with the universe. And I get that from the spiritual perspective, but feeling wise, it didn't feel good. It felt off and it felt wrong. And then what has transpired after that in this field has been extremely eye-opening, but it's almost like you can look at, you know, the transition of his passing and see what has happened in this arena has been, you know, just so convoluted and confusing. John Brown's level of respectability and, yes, and rigor, scientific rigor to this. And he was also a kind, nice person that had a tremendous presence. And, you know, he made me feel calm. And personally, when I would, you know, interact with him, and I felt like, wow, this is an incredible person that is taking this endeavor on. And now they're not here.
Oh, there's no question. He was one of these figures, you know, just it was kind of someone who really sets a totally different tone. It's interesting, too, when I think about that, because when you think about certain UFO researchers, and this goes all the way back to the 50s, winding up in unusual circumstances, all the way from Morris Jessup up to John Mack, you know, real deep UFO researchers share something in common with real deep breakthrough energy people, which is their work is very often suppressed. And we've seen very drastic measures around that at times coming from what appear to be the covert wing, the kind of ex-protect side of this government program. I don't think there's any question about it. What else have you got, Ms. Olivia?
Hey, Fractured wants to know, can you ask her about Rodin coils, pyramid power, and orgone energy?
The pyramid coils would be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, the Rodin coils. I've spoken with Mark Rodin. I know people that have tried to replicate the coils and try to get, energy from those. And it's been a little challenging. Let's see, orgone energy, Wilhelm Reich. I know a lot of people are creating orgone. I personally had an orgone pole in my yard in Massachusetts that was 12 feet long and actually got from Amish farmers many years ago and used it to, quote unquote, farm the atmosphere. And I felt like it definitely helped create a lot of coherency in my yard. let's see. And what was the other one?
Pyramid power.
I know that there's people that study that, and some study it, I would say, more intently and are more well-versed in it than others. And one of the individuals that I know that studies this extremely well has not come out with their work publicly, but they will soon. And they are working on a book that I would highly recommend that people get, but I can't say what it is now, and I can't say who this person is right now. But, you know, to me, he offers one of the greatest insights that has yet to come out yet. That has yet to come out. So what else can I say on that? There's there's a lot to say. I'm just not sure what, because those are three, you know, topics.
That's great, actually. Olivia, yeah. You're up.
Okay, to Algernon says, do the experiences, like the psychic, dreamlike experiences, do they always occur spontaneously, or are there ways to invite them in?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Okay, so from the research, and then I'll give you from my own stuff, what appears to be the case is most people have their experiences when they're alone, they're in bed, they are in meditation, they are either, you know, waking up when they're, you know, in bed, or they're going to sleep when they're in bed, or they're asleep. So now I was, you know, again, researching and looking at all of this, I'm trying to look and go, okay, what's the little method here? What's the thing that's actually, you know, helping to create this entry point? It truly does seem being calm, and being what I would call in that alpha state is very helpful to these encounters. So, you know, really creating like a calm, coherent type of environment and calming the heart really seems to open this up. And, you know, many people then begin going back into connecting either with the experience or with the beings that they've encountered, or they're trying to, you know, seek it out. But, you know, most people are accessing it back through meditation. It's almost like sometimes it feels like the beings are coming into their reality, and then, you know, it's awakening the contactee, and then the contactee is like, well, wait a second, you know, I'm in charge of this as well, so let me go and, you know, reach out back and try to commune back to get this information. So but what seems to come up over and over and over is, it's, you know, people are not having these experiences in yoga, or, you know, going to football, or, you know, at a dance. Like, it's this alone time and being in that space.
My God, if you had it at a football game, that would be something. It's
but it's also not happening in yoga. So I'm just like, it's not in a yoga class. They're not reporting it in a yoga class. I just want to make that point.
Is there anything that, you know, in the culture as we have it, you know, are you frustrated in a sense that the culture hasn't moved forward on some of these questions? I watched a program, which was a Donald Kehoe interview with Mike Wallace, who of 60 Minutes fame later. This conversation was from 1959, and so basically 60 years ago, and it was the same runaround dealing with the UFO file subject. It sounded exactly like the conversation that you'd hear now on 60 Minutes. Do you get frustrated?
No, not anymore. I used to, because I used to have an attachment to that, you know, the big boys were going to do disclosure and that we were all going to be free and happy. I mean, this was a long time ago. This wasn't like, you know, even in the last 10 years. You know, I think my faith in believing that someone else is going to do the right thing in this arena has definitely, it's gone. And this is where I realize we are the ones, you know, people say we're the ones that we're waiting for. It's like, well, yeah, because I'm looking around and it's like, well, you know, if you want morality to come into the picture in regards to breakthrough energy technology, then guess what? You know, you got to do it. You got to you know, work with the people that are showing, you know, those type of qualities, and you got to do it. So it doesn't frustrate me. I feel maybe a sense of a bit of sadness that still can become perpetuated and people can still listen to it and still believe it. But it doesn't frustrate me, because I see something more exciting that is happening and moving right now. And it feels like, you know, what Steiner talked about is opening. And it's for those people, I believe, that have shown up well and right for many, many years, even though they got pummeled down. And, you know, the time is coming. The time is now for it.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. Well, the John F. Kennedy quote on this was, if not us, who, if not now, when? Which I think is really kind of, you know, in the zeitgeist right now. Okay, Olivia, you're up.
Yeah, I wonder, Susan, can you talk about energy, free energy suppression stories that you know about? I mean, everybody always is curious about unfortunately, people who've been eliminated and patents that have been suppressed.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I hear stories. I've heard a lot of stories. And do I believe the stories? Sure. Have I personally experienced them? Not yet. And you know, to me, that's important. Does it mean it doesn't exist? Of course not. You know, I think we know it exists, and we know it's something that has happened and has gone on. It's not something that I have experienced personally. But again, have I heard stories firsthand of threatened, you know, people that have been threatened, you know, here in the United States and in Europe and in other parts of the world? 100%, absolutely. What seems to be more the case is what I would call energy that come, let's say energy, people that come into play to kind of divert it. You know, and I'm sure that there are people that are in, you know, the movement here that probably play on both sides of the arena as well, meaning that they may look like they're here to help people, but, you know, maybe they tip their hat to maybe a government agency or providing some intel to a big company. You know, maybe that's what happens and has gone on. There's speculation. I have not personally, you know, seen it or experienced. There are people that I will gravitate towards and people that I will move away from.
Right. Because I'm like people like Rife, for example, and his cancer cures treatment and stuff. There's a long tradition, a long history of suppressing things. It goes back to the Rockefellers, you know, shutting down medical innovation, shutting down hemp, shutting down advanced technology. You know, I mean, it's just something to live with in the society. Yeah. There's no question.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's why the it's important to have the awareness there. And that's why it's really important that the ecosystem, because how do those people penetrate? How are they penetrating? How are they coming in? And if the system is compromised, or if there's no system, it's easy, right? It's easy to just, you know, you don't even have to kill anybody. It's just easy to make it happen. So it's easy to discredit. It's easy to screw around with bank accounts and things like that. You know, it's easy, but this is why creating a stronger ecosystem is extremely important. That takes time to do things well and right. And with the people that feel the call to be a part of something that is allowing them to drop the ego and to have more of a shared I would say network, but a shared alliance with one another. So you know, is it there? Of course. And the rule that most inventors go through now is, you know, no, we're not going to patent it. If we really want to get it out, we're not going to go through the traditional patent method. And it's kind of like, it's known now that it's not something that you really want to do.
Right.
And you know, people have to be able to protect the knowledge and the information. And you know, most inventors don't have access to cybersecurity. Most things are not secure. And you know, that stuff is easy to you know, for the powers that be. So you know, we don't have to have the intense suppression like we used to have. There's easier ways to go about, unfortunately, doing it. So that's why it's important to be strategic.
Olivia, we got time for two more questions.
Okay, James Creevy. So why don't the inventors open source their inventions/discoveries? And what is our best bet at the moment for free energy?
Open source.
Nice question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, because how do we know what's really real and how do we know what's not? If somebody puts it on the internet, how do we know what's really real and what's really not? And unfortunately, there have been many, many, many devices and plans and things that are put on the internet, and many of them do not work. Now, some of them, it's put out there because of a distraction intentionally, and some of it just because the inventor doesn't know that they don't really have over Unity. So then you have many people that are, I mean, it takes time and money to really figure out what device you want to create, and you have to have the space to do it. You have to have the money to do it. You have to have I mean, you have to have things in order to do it, right? So, you know, when you talk about open sourcing, I know of invention recently from an inventor. And again, I'm not a technical engineer. Let me just, you know, come out and say that. But I work closely with people that are, and I have a different way that I go about, you know, doing what I do. But this inventor who I trust deeply, I've known this person for a very, very long time. There is a device, I don't know if it's still out there, that is shown and it works. And the chat on the board has already been infiltrated by people that are, you know, detracting away from it actually doing what it's supposed to do. So, you know, here we're living in a day and age where, you know, we think, oh, it should just be so simple, but it's going to not immediately get down, or, you know, the trolls or whomever, then whatever they are, you know, the AI stuff is not going to come in and screw with the whole thing. So, you know, how do we know that right. is trusted in well and right? Again, if there's a stronger infrastructure that's developed that comes from a credible source, that again has some form of credibility, then people would be more apt to do it. So I'm not against open sourcing by any means. It just becomes a bit of a challenge, especially when we know some of the regulations that are happening recently with, you know, freedom on the internet. You know, it becomes a bit more of a challenge.
Oh, well, no question. Yeah,
part to this question, I forgot what it was though.
No, it gets to the heart of it, which is, well, Olivia, you've got your last question.
Can I ask just a couple? This is kind of important. So what is happening internationally when, like, China, in Russia? Have you visited Russia?
No.
Okay.
And no. And by the way, I don't have anything against Russia. I don't have anything against China. I was invited to go to China to give a talk. I don't know about that. I still understand what they're really asking at this point, and what the conference is about. But, you know, here's what I know. You know, here we are talking about new energy technology, and some of these technologies, you know, we don't know entirely what they all do. So you have to be careful. And, you know, the DOD in the United States, I live in the United States, and the DOD interacting with devices and things of this nature in other countries like Russia, like China, and other Middle Eastern countries, you've got to be really careful.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's not, it's not just a free for all here. And let's just, you know, you've got to follow laws, and they may not be fair. They may not be right, but guess what? It's still the law, and you still have to, you know, follow and adhere to it. So, again, I have nothing against these countries. But I like to do things that are mindful of, you know, things truly from a legal perspective, because it's important to not get people in trouble and to not, you know, be rogue about some of this stuff. But I do know that there are some talented inventors that come from Russia, and I have not been over there. And at this point, I don't believe I'm communicating with anybody that is.
Well, it's interesting, though, you're right, which is there has to be a kind of standard, and you get that kind of standard. And when you're in these other countries, you have to deal with what they have, basically. Susan, this has been absolutely incredible. We're going to have you back because there's a part two to your story and the things that you're doing that I want to get into as well. So we're going to bring you back in September, if you're available, and go through that, because I know that there's a whole other arena and we just got cracking with it. But tell us briefly the name of the book and where people can get it, Beyond UFOs.
Sure. And there's two. So I think when I'm back in September, we really need to talk about the Hidden Energy book.
Yes.
But the first book is Beyond UFOs, The Science of Consciousness and Contact. It was designed for the academic community. And yes, I plan on giving it to former colleagues of mine and at places that I've taught and were clients of mine to say, hey, look, guess what? Guess what? Hey, would your university be interested in studying some of this now, finally? So that's what the book
Hey,
is
listen, you were
called.
20 years ahead of the game, is basically, you know.
Yeah, well,
That's what
it didn't win me many friends or parties, I can tell you that. Not that I'm a pretty person. But the other book is Hidden Energy, and I would really like to talk about that next time, because Jean Manning is a 30-year veteran in this arena, and we wrote this book. She's, by the way, when I say we wrote it, she's the writer. She somehow put up with me in this last, you know, almost 2 years with traveling around and having crazy things happen, and we were able to come up with a really amazing book that your readers.
Well, we know Jean Manning also co-wrote the Heart book with Nick Begich back in 1996, so she has that incredible background, incredible history, and the two of you together is just dynamite. I can't wait till that book comes out. When is that book coming out?
That's going to be out in the fall of 2018. So it's almost wrapped up. There's a couple of small things that need to be done, but that will be out in the fall of 2018. And people can sign up for it. It's hiddenenergy.org, and you can get on the mailing list, and then we'll keep you updated as to what's happening and going on. And you know, we're not a big operation here. I was on the back end of the website the other day trying to figure out how to get everything well and right. But it's a book, you know, when you think about it for a second, it is from the feminine perspective, but it's definitely hard hitting with all the tech and that information is there. And that we need to thank Jean for. But you also get to see how these inventors are inspired. And, you know, to me, when you look at these two books together, you start to get a more rapid understanding about how breakthrough energy is actually related to, you know, these pieces of information that people are getting in non-traditional ways.
Absolutely fascinating. It's incredible stuff. The timing is perfect, too. If it's going to come out in the fall, we'll have you come out and talk about everything that's in there. And I know some of the exciting aspects we've touched on privately. I want you to talk about all of those publicly and all the interesting things that you'll be announcing also in the fall. You know, so the work that you're doing, this is going to be something to watch, everyone. Susan Manowich, who's now the president of the New Energy Movement. And we will have you back in the fall. So we'll set that up and you can tell me when the book is coming out. In the meantime, everyone, get the Beyond UFOs book. It has that incredible background and contributing authors, but Susan's chapter is particularly fascinating, dealing with, you know, this whole aspect that we're talking about in the series. Olivia, thank you. Unbelievable, incredible questions as
Just,
usual.
Can I ask one last question?
Yeah, sure.
So Susan, do you have an email for people who have been contacted who have some, obviously some messages, some insights and innovations?
Do you mean on the...
like if they have had a download?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you mean in terms of like inventors and stuff?
Yeah. Well, if let's say they are,
what's
they
the
are
best way to contact you?
Yeah.
Hold on. What's the best way to contact you publicly?
Oh, publicly. Well, let's see. publicly is, I would say at this point is through a Facebook message. If you do that
on Facebook,
only because sometimes I'm not getting all of my emails that are coming in through the other one. And if somebody does that, you know, you can find me publicly, and then I just have to do that accept thing on there. Don't friend me. It doesn't mean I don't want to be your friend. It means that I'm just really behind on that stuff. But if you just send me a message and you know, that first tagline on there is like dark journalist, then I'll pick it up because, you know, Daniel and Olivia, I know you guys, so that's coming through that avenue. So then I'll be able to pick it up that way. And
Fantastic.
Also, I'm on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is also nice. It's a clean, easy way to get through to me too.
Absolutely. So you can people can find you at Susan Manowich on Facebook or find you in LinkedIn. And
wait, one more. The Hidden Energy. Well, because I just got a new one. The Hidden Energy, Susan at hiddenenergy.org.
Okay, let's do that. That's easy. Okay. SusanEdHiddenEnergy.org. Forget all the other stuff. Just go there. This has been
it's
great.
Late, you guys. It's late. I'm usually in bed now.
Listen, I know that you've been really active the past couple of days putting this all together too. And you're working, you're always juggling a dozen projects. And I can always say this in relation to Susan's work. she's going very deep, and she's not big at advertising the stuff that she's up to. And she doesn't do a lot of, you know, kind of big marketing schemes for her stuff. She's just doing the incredible deep work, and we all really appreciate it. Susan, amazing stuff and unbelievable work. I can't wait to hear more. We'll have you back in September, and it's great to see you.
Thank you so much, and maybe I can sit with you in person. That way I don't have to mess around with the Google Hangout stuff.
That's going to be a whole lot better. I can't wait. Yeah, fantastic. Right. But it's great to have you here anyway through the magic of crazy wireless. Miss Olivia, fantastic. Great stuff.
And you don't want to field any questions? Where Susan leaves?
No. We're done for tonight. Okay. We're coming back next Friday at 7
Not
p.m.
Not even one?
Olivia, look, you're the boss. You know, I
say, the boss.
You say jump and I say how high. Okay. You know how it works around here.
Well,
go ahead.
A cult fan wanted me to ask, would you be willing to speak to the interesting hand position utilized in your most recent photo with Susan?
Well, I think it was it this?
It was something. It was something like this.
I think this. Well, I would say what's interesting is, you know, people do a lot of things unconsciously. So if you read things into it, I'm very fascinated to see what you got out of it. But what's most interesting that I find is I look for steganography, you know, due to my work in the X series, everywhere. And it is interesting the things that you can read into things. Are they there? Are they not there? It's kind of an interesting perspective. So yeah, whatever you come up with is probably as interesting as anything I would do.
Okay, we can end on this question.
Okay.
So Najat is asking, what's the relationship to the modern new free energy movement to X? This is what it's all coming down to.
You know, that's going to be something that Susan and I will answer when she comes back in September. That way, we'll guarantee we'll get her back because, you know, Susan, she's all over the world. If you can get her, it's important. So, Najat, that's when you'll get your answer. It's great to have you out there. It's fantastic. What a great crowd we had tonight. Excellent people. Jay Mallett, Agent 420, Bill Davis, a cult fan. Everyone is here. Fantastic show. And it's great just to have all this interesting info from Susan. And imagine dealing with things like breakthrough energy and, you know, the UFO file and all that stuff and actually getting somewhere with it, actually doing something that helps people and isn't the cause of controversy because so many people are swirling around with so many crazy stories or taking advantage. You know, it's a very different world, isn't it? When you get actually right to a real researcher and somebody is doing the really hardcore work on the ground and putting themselves in the middle of it. That's what we look for when we do this stuff. That's hopefully what we do with the X series also. We will see you next week on Friday at 7 p.m. And also what I want to mention is we're going to have Gigi Young here and we're going to go very deep into the Rad Lab connection to theosophy, and it's going to be an episode you don't want to miss. It's absolutely crucial. Remember to go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for the free newsletter that keeps us in touch with each other. That's the best way to do it. YouTube is here today, gone tomorrow. Look at Alex Jones. Who, Susan, before you go, do you want to mention your story about meeting Alex Jones? Susan met Alex Jones.
Oh, sure. Well, if people remember, I lived in Hawaii. I lived on Kauai. Yes. And I visited there last year to go back. And I brought my daughter back because she had friends there. And I'm standing in line and I was actually really tired and really in need of a coffee in the morning. And I'm not a huge coffee drinker, but just in the last year, I don't know, it's just kind of like it's become a thing. So I'm really tired and I'm in line. And all of a sudden I hear, hey. Look at this long line, and obviously it's like, oh my god, am I hearing this man? Is this like in my ear and her voice? And then all of a sudden I turn around and there's Alex Jones, and you know, he's right there, and he's really loud, and you know, I look at him obviously because he's standing directly behind me, and he goes, hi. And I said, well, hi, how are you? And he said something like, oh, you know who I am? And he goes, do you like me? Because most people don't really like me, and I have to be careful. Anyways, and then we got into a conversation about about breakthrough energy, and basically he said, I can't make sense of that stuff. I don't know what to believe. I'm like, well, at some point there's going to be a book. You know, this was a year ago. I said, that comes out. So if you're interested, I'd be happy to send you a copy of it. But that was the extent of the conversation.
I'm going to say this for the record, which is, regardless of what anyone thinks of Alex Jones, them, you know, Apple and YouTube and everyone stripping him all at the same time and the FCC cracking down on him, it's totally unfair stuff. Okay. And I totally object to it in the worst way. That's why ultimately the social media companies can't be trusted. And we just had the wonderful Wall Street Journal article detailing how Facebook was going to big banks trying to trade information, like, we'll give you information on these people if you tell us how much money they have in their bank account. I mean, that's the level that these people are on. That's the whole corporate zone. And those are the people who shut Alex down. So as I often say on this program, it's not a political thing. You know, it's like, just like people, if they don't approve of Trump, shouldn't approve of the CIA trying to remove him. That's, you know, we have a constitution for a reason, and we have a free speech clause for a reason. So even if you don't like Alex Jones' speech, you should still support his right to speak and all the other people like the Ron Paul Institute that they shut down at the same time. Oh yeah, a lot of hate speech coming from Ron Paul, audit the Federal Reserve, for example. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of, it's fascinating. But your story, the spontaneous story with Alex always cracks me up. It's great.
It was funny. He was funny. I mean, I'll be honest, because his voice, I actually don't think he's capable of whispering. And when people think he's screaming, I think that that's actually his normal voice. I don't think he's capable of whispering.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, yeah, he's definitely, you know, this is somebody who can project quite a lot. There's no question. There's, you know, that's probably his morning voice, right? He just wakes up that way.
You know what? That was, I don't think he has an off button. I think that is his button. Really? I mean, this is not
an God put him on for a reason. Let's face it.
Exactly. I mean, hearing that at like 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, when you least expect it on this little, you know, little island out in the middle of the Pacific, it's like, what is happening here?
This is a very Susan story as we get deep into this. And in part two, people are really going to get even more of that. Like, you have a lot of those, and I always find them interesting.
What? Funny stories?
Well, you people turn up around you. It's an interesting thing.
They do. They do.
It's great to see you.
Sounds fabulous. It's nice to see you as well. Thank you.
It's really great. And I can't wait for the new book. And I'll see you when you're back in town.
All right. Very good. Thank you again. Good night. Aloha. And have a beautiful, beautiful weekend.
Thank you,
Susan.
Bye, and Olivia, what can I say? You did an incredible job, as
Thank
usual.
You. Very rowdy group tonight.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, Friday is Friday, but hey, that's odd. That's a little odd. Whenever we get around interesting, controversial subjects, there's always a strain there that tries to throw the conversation
Definitely.
Off. But as usual, you held it right down the middle, and you picked out the best questions, and you're still the most popular.
What
can we say?
That Irish term that you taught me earlier today?
This is a Gaelic term, which is hug a maho.
And it means?
Kiss my...
Okay. I wanted to...
that's a term you wanted to use.
No, I wanted to do that as a shout-out to Bernadette Black and all of her friends in Ireland. She'll know.
Hug him a ho.
And she was asking, how much money on all these secret experiments? And just very quickly, how many, you know...
Catherine Austin Fitz says 50 trillion missing.
It's 50 trillion.
So, you know, that's the missing money. By the way, missingmoney.solari.com tracks the missing money. It's free. Can you believe that?
What is the site again?
missingmoney.solari.com. Okay. That's Catherine's site, and there's a whole thing where she tracks it. How great is that? You know, you don't even have to pay for it. It's amazing. Everyone, it's great to have you here. And Olivia, what's for dinner?
I'm too pooped. I'm not going to eat anything. I'm done.
Well,
you have to go
on the record.
I'll have a simple lemonade. How's that? I'm cleansing. No more alcohol for a little while.
You're making me sound like an alcoholic.
Well, you don't drink at all.
Exactly. Wow. It's great to have everyone here. We will see you next Friday at 7 p.m. X23, Gigi Young. She's going to be here August 24th, next Friday. We'll see you then.
Good night, everybody.